We have several recognitions this morning. Dr. Iser.
Chairman Beers, would you
join me? Yep. First is Gary Robinson. Please step up.
And Jackie, why don't you come up here too? So I was very pleased to go to the county's recognition of Gary Robinson for the effort that he put forth for which he was nominated for this award. And let me read that to you. It's a certificate of recognition 2015, and I think we did this about 5 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. To Gary Robinson, thank you for providing customer service and excellence. From Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority and the Las Vegas Metro Chamber of Commerce. This was a special event that had literally so many people there they couldn't fit us all into one room at one time. I guess we actually got into the first set of recognitions. And I will tell you that there was a sort of a comedian there as the MC. Do you mind me telling the story? And we were one of the last to be recognized, and they asked Gary where he was from, and he said Southern Nevada Health District. And the comment was, ooh, all those restaurants. And he was joking about, I guess, the writer or the television reporter, whoever she is, who comments on some of our bad restaurant inspections. Let me see if Gary has something he wants to say. You don't have to.
Well, you get a nomination, and I don't think I did anything extraordinary or anything that any other inspector wouldn't do, but I guess it just comes down to hard work and maybe a smiling face. Maybe that's what gets a nomination.
Well, if that's true, our board members would get nominated every year. Thank you, Gary, for your for this recognition, and I was happy, as was Jackie, to be with you. Our second recognition goes to a board member who has been here for quite a while and was our previous board chair, and we'd ask Rod Woodbury to step up and to formally recognize him and our pride in him at becoming the new mayor of the city of Boulder City. So thank you.
As well, a ceremonial gavel for your time here on the Southern Nevada Health District. We really appreciated your leadership through some difficult times.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll postpone the next recognition until Bill Noonan can come to a board meeting. We were told that he would likely not be able to come today.
Okay. Is there a motion to adopt the... Oh, I'm sorry. First, we come to a period of public comment, a period devoted to comments by the general public about items appearing on today's agenda. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes per speaker. Please step up to the speaker's podium. Clearly state your name and address. Spell your last name for the record. If any member of the board wishes to extend the length of your presentation, this can be done by the chairman or by the board by majority vote. Public comment today?
Hi, Victoria Harding, disease investigator here and vice president of SEIU 1107 for SNHD. Really what I wanted to talk about, I always read the attachments to the agenda that I get, and it's very interesting. I was looking at the nursing, basically the director of clinical services and nursing services, and I'm looking at every single thing that we do in there, and it's an amazing amount of work. And this is not the stuff that you see on the typical agenda little items. This is such an amount of work that people do, and as I looked through it, and I'm checking off, wow, nurses are doing that. Nurses are doing that. There's pretty much not an area in here that a nurse is not involved in our clinical area. And they're doing just the most amazing things. And I had emailed the board about some issues that I had with posting of the position replacing Bonnie, who's our director of nursing for right now, with an MD versus an RN, which really, you know, I talked about it before. the law states that. Thank you. Thank you. I lost my thought.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll gain it back. But basically, you know, I'd spoken previously, so I don't really have to speak to you all on the legality of that issue. But I do want to tell you that I was at the AFL-CIO conference or convention recently, and our advisory board member, who's an RN, happened to be there, Michael Collins, with me. We were both delegates. And so he had known this was happening, and I said, hey, you know, that thing happened. They actually posted this position. And it's an MD, and the nurses, our managers, are now going to be these quasi-directors. And he just looked at me, and he went, which is very Michael Collins, if you know Michael Collins. And he didn't say anything. So later on, he's texting, and he's walking by, and he says, Victoria, that thing that you mentioned, in a hospital, you have to have a nurse at an administrative level that is equal to the other administrators, top administrators in that facility, or you cannot be accredited. And I thought, that was my turn to go, that's very interesting, because, you know, this is one of the other things that's in, you know, everything that we look at is all of the accreditation things that we look at and are trying to achieve. Are we shooting ourselves in the foot by doing something that may actually affect our accreditation? Because I'm assuming accreditation, one of the things they're going to want is that we follow NRS state law. That would be first and foremost. And as such, the nursing division asked me to do a petition, because they wanted to speak out on this issue. So, and I'll read it really quick. It's really short. We are frontline nurses and employees of the Southern Nevada District Health District, dedicated to our community and our jobs, demand that our district health officer comply with Nevada state law and replace our director of nursing with a nurse. Under NRS 632.240 system for delivery of health care, nursing services must be supervised by a chief administrative nurse. The provision of nursing services in any system for the delivery of health care must be under the direction and supervision of a chief administrative nurse who is a registered nurse. I am fully aware of my rights and specifications as our contract, and I'm signing this letter demanding the management uphold the law. Sincerely, a dedicated nurse who puts patients first. And I think the last thing is really important. They put patients first. That's what this whole thing is about. It's pages and pages long of what our nurses do here and how important they are. And I really, really would worry that they aren't even being represented at a level that they need to be represented at in this organization. Because if you look at organizationally, I'm a disease investigator. I used to be in the nursing division. Bonnie represented me. Everything kind of went up the organizational chart and ended at Bonnie. She did represent me. I moved over now to community health. It's Dr. Lockett who represents me. I have a voice. When you look at the organizational chart now, these nurses in this new classification of it, where does it go? There's no nursing even mentioned anywhere in our new clinic's job description. So I'm wondering who is really representing these nurses now at the top level. And I just have some issues with that, just programmatically for us, besides the legal aspect. And I think Michael Collins was right. We have to look at it for accreditation as well. And there's just a lot of things to think about. So I did want to present that petition to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is anybody else who would like to speak at this time? Okay, hearing and seeing none, we will close the public comment section, agenda item 2, and take up agenda item 3, the adoption of this agenda for this meeting.
Move for approval.
Second.
We have a motion by Member Scow, a second by Member June Kiliani, and a third by Member Dobine. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The agenda is adopted. Agenda item 4 is our consent agenda. These are items for action to be considered by the board, which may be enacted by one motion. Any item can be pulled off of this consent agenda by a board member merely by asking, and then we will take that item up separately.
I just had one overall question.
Yep. And then I'd make a motion. All of them are the standard shared services agreement. Was anything changed that we should know about? I didn't see anything, but not to compare
no,
it to.
These are the standard agreements okay. that we have with all the fire districts and others to share information and of course, you know, we have the
right. What I didn't see was the new creation of the Mount Charleston Fire District. Did that have to be separate, or does it go still through the county?
I'll ask Mr. Hammond, who is the new director of the office, to come up.
Good morning. My name is John Hammond. I'm the EMS and Trauma System Manager for the Southern Nevada Health District. In regard to the Mount Charleston Fire District, they have not yet applied for a permit as okay. an agency.
They're in the process. I know that they just came to before the board. So.
As soon as they are, we'll issue them
okay.
the same.
All right. Agreement. Thank you. Then I would, if there's no other questions, I would make a motion to adopt the consent agenda, Mr. Chair.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion passes. This brings us to agenda item 5, items for public hearing and action. Members of the public are allowed to speak on public hearing action items after the board's discussion and prior to our vote. Each speaker will be limited to 5 minutes to address the board on the pending topic. No person may yield his or her time to another person. In those situations where large groups of people desire to address the board on the same matter, I may request that you select one or two speakers from your group to address the board on behalf of the entire group. Once the public hearing is closed, no additional public comment will be accepted. 5-1 is memorandum number 05-15, consider or adopt Southern Nevada Health District proposed regulations governing the management of solid waste to direct staff accordingly or take other action as deemed necessary. Welcome.
So approximately...
Please state your name for the record.
Brian Northam. I'm in environment.
Now we can hear you. Okay.
Good morning again, everyone. This is Brian Northam. I'm the environmental health supervisor of the permitted disposal program in Southern Nevada Health District.
That's on.
Approximately a year ago, it was requested of my department to draft comprehensive regulations for the management of solid waste within Clark County to consolidate, simplify, and clarify the myriad sets of regulations we have governing these industries. It took about a year to get it all put together to bring the 7 sets all into one place and combine everything into the document you have in front of you to review before today. At this point, honestly, I could go over it in more detail, or we could just go on to what questions you have. We did minor changes to the vast majority of the document itself. I'm sorry, that mic is not working. Does this one work? There we go.
Lights on.
A little bit of technical difficulties. The document brought everything into one place under one current set of definitions, so we could put everything into a clear and concise manner for industry and the regulated community all to be on the same page. By doing that, we've just clarified everything for everyone. The minor changes in the document, the approval process has been slightly altered to allow a legal appeal process, which we've received complaints from industry and from other regulators, i.e. the state, that we did not have an approved appeal process because there was no methodology to contest and protest the issuance of the permit. That has been addressed and is in the document. At this point, I would take any questions the board has on this.
Before I ask any questions, I just want to state how great of a job you guys did. I actually read this whole thing, and it was riveting. But approximately 4 years ago, I sat down with the previous administration and to talk about this exact thing and was told it was never going to happen. So I'm so pleased to see that Jackie and your staff took this up and got it done. And this is how good it is. This is my entire question out of all this. over on page 7 of 83, where you talk about the commingled recyclable materials. You talk about residual solid waste, but I see we still haven't defined what residual is anywhere, or maybe I missed it.
It is in Appendix 1.
It is in, okay.
It is. And the definition for that was actually taken directly from county code, which corresponds from what I'm understanding, North Las Vegas, City of Henderson, and soon to be City of Las Vegas.
Good. That was my entire questions.
Any other board members?
So that was the only change, the legal process?
No, there are other changes. What it has done is it has added in things that were being done that were not codified necessarily. They were methodologies and better descriptions of things as far as the requirements that facilities had to do. They were in the past covered by all other documentation as required because there were requirements from either other jurisdictions or other approvals and things deemed necessary for permitting. Now they are more clearly spelled out in there. The phrase of all of the documentation as required unfortunately does and must remain due to the changing industries we have. If new things come out that we would need to have in the future, we would need to be able to get those documents from the regulated facilities.
We cannot
forecast and try and determine what will be required by law 5 years from now because we just don't know. So we need to leave that phrase in. But it's just a better clarification of the documents required at this point.
What phrase are you speaking of? I'm sorry.
The exact term is going to be in section chapter 2 under – sorry, it's going to take me a minute to find it.
If you could give us maybe a page number.
When I find it, I will.
Okay.
On page 20, it would be chapter 2-2.013G. Documentation showing any other permits necessitated by the reported design or operating plan for the solid waste management facility issued by agencies of jurisdiction as applicable, i.e. air, fire, stormwater, building department, et cetera. If another permitting agency determines there is a necessary permit for the operation, we would want a copy of that in our files so we can say, yes, we were assured that it was approved by whatever jurisdiction.
Okay, so for example, we have, say, air quality gets a call. We actually had an issue with somebody burning out by the way out. and I had to call air quality because I had some concerns from constituents about it out towards Sunrise. And so then if they determine a permit was needed, then they just automatically copy you? How would you know to make sure that you get whatever permits are being required by the other jurisdictions?
If I had a facility that was going to be in the application process, because that's
it really wasn't a legal facility.
If it's a legal facility, it does not comply with these regulations. It's an illegal facility.
Okay, so then who has authority to shut someone down?
If it's a solid waste facility, we do. If they're not permitted, they'd be issued cease and desist order and follow the standard notice of violation administrative process that was not affected by these regulations. These regulations do, in fact, supersede all solid waste regulations. However, the hearing officer process is outside of these.
Okay, so then your new appeal procedure process added a legal appeal process separate from the hearing master then?
The legal appeal process for the issuance of a permit would be approved internally and signed by the Director of Environmental Health. If there is a protestation or a conflict and someone wants to appeal that, that permit issuance is appealed to this board.
Okay, so we're the final board.
Correct.
And the commingled solid waste, are you breaking out or you're continuing to break out what they have to report as each individual business so you know what tonnage – what waste is coming from where?
We need the material to be commingled. The recyclables material is listed from each facility annually in the recycling report, mm-hmm. and has to be separated by commodity.
Correct.
And they would still continue to report that. In fact, now it's a broader scope because these regulations combine everything, everyone recycling the material. We have to be very careful with that report. It's a complicated report due to the fact that if, say, Rod had a facility and he accepted a bunch of scrap metal, well, we would want to count that in our report, but we have to make sure he doesn't take it to Mr. Beer's facility. And we don't want to
double
count.
And how do you do that? Because it is all self-reporting. And I think the companies do a pretty good job.
It's all tracked on the reporting information they submit to the health district. They submit the volume, say, 1,000 tons, and then they say 750 tons went to SA Recycling and 250 tons went to California. Well, the California would be counted in our number. The 750 is already counted at SA.
How about anything that goes to China?
That would be counted again going out as usually.
I've never noticed.
Usually goes to Port of Long Beach. It's not usually documented as China.
That's what I'm thinking. It goes to the ship, yes. is what it does, and that's why it doesn't appear that way.
It is all counted as it's actually not even counted that closely. What we're going to count is in county and out of county. In county is going to another facility in town, so it'd be double reported if we counted it. Out of county is being counted as China, Utah, wherever it's going.
Do you ever audit to make sure that what you're being told is accurate?
Other than to check the records of the facility, that's all we could do. And we do check the records of the facility every time we inspect them.
It's maybe a gap there, but down the road we may want to talk, Mr. Chair, about some kind of presentation or an audit or something to deal with just solid waste and all that. When we look at runoff, I've noticed runoffs used in there. I think we got in trouble for not having not having a proper program in place for collecting the runoff. Do we monitor that, even if NDEP doesn't do it then?
This NDOT was the one that was just recently
in the news.
Okay,
that's what
it was. And that was an EPA decision. All facilities that get any permit from this department are required to have stormwater control permits, the SWIP permits that are listed in here is one of the requirements. We can't enforce that regulation, but we can require that it is done. And we can require testing on some of the facilities that actually have interceptors. We're going to require records to make sure they're being maintained. We're going to, as we see it, the runoff devices, the hay bales and the straw wattles, mm-hmm. we verify those again at time of inspection.
You used an interesting term. You can't enforce it even though it's your own regulation?
No, we can't enforce stormwater law.
Ah.
We can enforce our document. We can require they have the plan. If we see something that our knowledge tells us mm-hmm. is a violation of the plan, we can bring it to their attention and tell them to fix it. But ultimately, stormwater is the agency of jurisdiction for stormwater.
Which would be NDEP?
Clark County.
Or Clark County first, and then, okay.
Then NDEP, yes. And ultimately EPA.
That's what I have for right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other board members' comments?
What we have in front of us is the final product, but we don't have what it used to be, and we don't really have like a red line showing the changes, and I don't know if that's even possible when you're melding all these things together. We don't even really have a summary of what the changes were. So, as riveting as this may be to review, it's difficult for me to pick out, what the changes might have been. For instance, landfills, what did you change with landfills? Did you change the fundamental definitions of what solid waste is or refuse or things like that? I mean, there's just a lot of different areas here. And so I know that what I'm voting on, it would be nice to have some kind of summary of what the changes are.
Can you clarify? What was included to the packet was we had our original draft, and then all the comments were included to the board, and then a summary of revisions from those comments was included to the board.
Okay.
Are you asking for a red line from original law?
Well,
or
I'm,
from the comments?
Maybe
from the
I'm
public?
Just not looking in the right place. Is it on?
It was submitted to the board. I don't know if someone else has an iPad that has found it. I don't know what's on the iPad, but it was
all
submitted.
All I'm seeing on the iPad is just the final
exactly.
version.
It was, I could
There's
tell you.
There's a whole table of content. 109 pages on here.
Yeah, I'm looking at, I'm starting on page 100 of my printed packet, which my office printed. I don't know.
On the online, it did have that other backup. I know it's not on the
iPad.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so I guess my point is maybe you could give us some highlights of some of the changes.
Sure.
And, of course, we'd like to hear from the public as well if we have any solid waste operators here. And I appreciate that Mr. Dubine is a little bit of an expert in the industry and gives me a little bit of comfort that he likes the changes. But
yeah. We received comments from basically three entities. The Nevada Division of Environmental Protection submitted comments, Western Elite submitted comments, and Republic Service submitted comments. The comments were replied to in the document that was in the packet but apparently didn't end up on the iPad. A lot of the comments from NDEP were minor technical things. The state changed the definition of hauler of waste tires years ago, so we had the old definition. We had to take out the 10-tire exclusion. So now if you have 8 tires and you're a waste tire hauler, you're still a waste tire hauler unless they're your tires. That's a state law thing. We had to do it because our definition was less stringent, so we had to change it. Some of the state comments, they had misread their law, and we had to respond to. We've got about 50 comments. We go through them one by one, I guess, here. In the document summary of revisions, the state asked about the definition of empty container, which is a Resource Conservation Recovery Act 1976 definition from the EPA. They wanted the phrase "to 1 inch or less" added to it. The phrase basically comes down to a container is empty if it has 1 inch or less or less than 1% of the volume based on container size. So we added the phrase. The hauler waste tires I spoke of a second ago was the 10 tires or less amendment.
Yeah, and, sorry for interrupting. You don't need to go through every comment, but if you could give, you know, if there's sweeping changes in one area, that would, I mean, I understand there's probably, you got to change some phrases to comply with state law and things like that, but anything that you consider a major change?
Of the comments that came in, none of the comments received by staff and myself were deemed as large changes to the document. The vast majority of the comments came in where, can you add, change this word, which doesn't change definition? Okay, that was okay. I didn't have a problem with that. Let's see. One of them was literally just add two words. And I think definition of solid waste is one of the comments. They wanted to add the word sewage in there. It was already inferred but not specifically written. So if they wanted to add it, okay, I'll add it. The definitions that were added by comments from Western Elite and Republic Services, they wanted the definitions from Clark County Code, Title IX, changed and moved in. So County Title IX Code for construction demolition waste, let's see, solid waste, agricultural waste, bulky item, buyback center, commercial recycler, dead animals, residual solid waste, and sewage were all added. It did not change the scope of the regulations, didn't change the intent of the regulations, but that was a comment added. The better definition, I'm sorry, for adding words, Republic wanted the definition of Class 1, Class 2 landfill or site modified. The definition previously stated that...
Brian, I think what Mr. Woodbury is asking about is major kinds of things. I think if there aren't any major ones that you can identify for him now because they're all minor, and if Mr. Dubine or other people can't help to point that out, I think you might be okay.
Right. Doug, any major changes that you think we should know?
I saw. I mean, I agree with Brian. A lot of these were small things that need to be tweaked up.
Okay. Maybe we could hear from the public if there are any concerns about these.
Mr. Chair, before we do that, and I would agree, could you finish explaining about the Class 1 and Class 2 changes?
Class 1 and Class 2. This was one of the minor typographical things that they wanted to add. Class 1 site means a disposal site which is comprised of at least one municipal solid waste landfill unit is the NAC definition. Republic Services requested that we add or cell because cell is a defined term in the document and unit was not. It does not change the intent or scope of the document at all, but it does clarify.
So tell me what is or sale.
Or cell. I'm sorry. Landfill cell is a section of a landfill, E-L-L. A defined term.
Oh, cell.
Yes.
C-E-L-L. Okay. Sometimes what's innocuous, having written law, is very what's important to one can change completely a wordsmithing. So
absolutely.
I think that's – I agree with Mr. Woodbury. So for future at least, we should have – a red lined. I did find the summary now on page 100, but I didn't see the red line piece, so we really know what the changes are. Sometimes we might get called by somebody and say, what do they mean by that? And you don't even know where to go to reference it. So, but maybe we hear from the industry, and then we can have further discussion.
Any additional board member comments or questions at this time? Then I would open this up for a public comment. Any members of the public wishing to comment, please step forward and do so.
Good morning, board members. My name is Bob Coyle, C-O-Y-L-E, representing Republic Services. We're very supportive of these new regulations. Basically, there were 7, 8, 10 different sets of regulations with different definitions in them. And I, you know, want to compliment Brian. He's done a magnificent job in combining all those regulations into one document that we can now use comprehensively and know how we need to run our compliance programs, need to run our businesses. He's just done a remarkable job. He's also added Commissioner June Kiliani several years ago, asked for medical waste regulations. They are now in place. And all the definitions comply with what the city ordinances look like, and that just makes things a whole lot easier to operate as well as to maintain our facilities in compliance with the law and the regulations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coyle. Any other members of the public wishing to speak to address this item? Okay, I don't see any, so we'll close the public hearing and entertain a motion.
I'd like to make the motion that we accept the proposed solid waste regulations.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Congratulations, Brian. Take a drink.
Just soda, so we're good here.
Mr. Chair, would it be possible for Brian to give the jurisdictions a list of who is permitted to do what? Just because there's a lot of new companies, a lot of them are just doing C&D. There's a lot of the smaller haulers. I'd just be curious to see who actually is out there, you know, Par 3, Lunas, you know, those types of things. It might be helpful so we make sure that we know who's actually permitted to be out there doing what.
Do you have a contact person that you would like it sent to at each jurisdiction, a specific department, individual, anything like that?
I'm trying to think of who in our local governments who would make.
Actually, I'd like to see the county list with the jurisdiction added as a field.
That'd be good.
Yeah. And we
some
can
of us,
send that.
Some of us have borders.
Yeah, we overlap in some areas, yeah.
We can actually put this together in some sort of a spreadsheet and send it out to all of you. Or we can just include it as in the section titled Consent Agenda as a document for you to review.
Whatever works best. I'm just thinking it would be helpful to see, and you're right, because of do countywide and then break out from municipalities so that there may be folks that jurisdictionally hop around. Right.
So it may be easier for us just to email it from Jackie to all of you.
Yeah, right. Okay. I think so.
All the jurisdictions are represented here.
I'll get it put together.
Just when you thought you had checked off the last thing
Sorry,
on your
Brian.
List of things to do.
This is additional stuff. This is no big deal. This is everyday work.
That's
it's no
easy.
Big deal.
I'm
like
big cup there.
I don't mind, actually. Anyway, I thank you all for your time. Have a nice
day. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Okay, agenda item 5, sub 2, memorandum number 06-15. Consider and adopt amendments to the Southern Nevada Health District regulations governing the sanitation of used mattresses, bedding, and upholstered furniture. Direct staff accordingly or take other action as deemed necessary. Welcome. Please.
Good morning, board members. Paul Klaus from Environmental Health Manager, Dan Lou Rubio, Environmental Health Supervisor Engineer. This may look very familiar. This came before the board in January of 22nd of 2015, just 8 months ago, and has been returned to this body due to concerns raised by State Environmental Health regarding the dry heat temperature set as minimum for sanitizing mattresses. Just as background, NRS 444010 mandates the health authority regulate the sale of used mattresses, the means of sterilization that must be used for must be used to sell used mattresses, and the labeling for used mattresses. So this regulation contained language that was This was developed in cooperation with the industry that allowed for a dry heat method temperature of 125 degrees for 1 hour. The temperature was a recommended temperature to kill bed bugs. However, it's not considered a sanitizing or sterilizing temperature that would reduce or eliminate pathogens from a mattress. So State Environmental Health, as it was going forward to the State Board, raised some concerns and asked us to withdraw it from the State Board, come back, revise it, and, of course, then once we revised it, we had to reworkshop it and then bring it back to this board so we can take it back to the state. State Environmental Health contacted us with concerns regarding the dry heat temperature standard and suggested we revise the language to the temperature taken from the CDC guidelines published for hospital-grade sterilization. The regulation was drawn from consideration of State Board of Health, and staff worked with industry to see if the temperature recommendations would be qualitatively and economically feasible. We work with at least one facility out there in the industry to actually go out and test to see if the 300 degrees that was being recommended would actually be functional. Unfortunately, it burned the mattresses. So so we had to go back and start looking for another standard. Then we went back and started looking at the state regulations, which revealed that a majority of the approved sterilization methods were, in fact, sanitization methods, not actual sterilization, meaning the reduction, not elimination, of potential pathogens. A sanitizing standard was found in the California Bureau of Home Furnishings and Thermal Insulation Regulations, which required a temperature of 230 degrees Fahrenheit for 75 minutes, 205 for 90. So we have replaced the 125 degrees for 1 hour standard with that standard in the new document. State Environmental Health let us know yesterday that they will support that as amended. In addition, as a result of public workshop comments the second time around, and discussions with the industry, we have incorporated a one-time, we changed the program from a permit inspection program to a registration program, which is approval is administrative in nature and inspection is on complaint only. So when they come in, we take a look at their operational plan, we make sure it's in compliance with the regulations, we offer them, we give them approval, and they conduct their business. And if we get complaints regarding concerns about the sanitation or sterilization, then we'll go out and conduct an investigation. We also included, as part due to public comment regarding the fact that the regulation didn't have enough teeth or the ability to go after facilities that conduct this business without registration, we included, incorporated hearing officer process was essentially the same language with a few very minor changes to the same as the solid waste hearing regulations. So it's a hearing officer process. We take it before a hearing officer. We issue a notice of violation to a facility that's operating without registration and doing things outside of the law. We bring him before a hearing officer. And that's pretty much the only changes to the document that exist beyond the approval from this board on January 22nd. So, do you have any questions or concerns?
I have a couple questions, if I might. You mentioned the issue of sanitation versus sterilization. So we really don't sterilize and lift.
Well, when we took a look at the state regulation, right, there was only one of the four listed that you could do that was actually could be interpreted as sterilization, and that was putting it in an autoclave, essentially.
I remember the 07 when we had that
250 degrees under pressure.
Right.
And the rest of them that were already in state regulation saying you could do this, you could do that, including the application of a disinfectant pesticide chemical. Boiling it for an hour, that's still not sterilization. It's still sanitation. This regulation also includes the same language as it had on January 22nd, which is an alternate method. It allows staff to review and approve an alternate method because we can't think of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got what the state regulation has. We've got dry heat. And then if somebody wants to come to us and make a proposal, hey, I've got this great new idea, then we can work with them and do that.
Okay, so on page 4 of 11, I think, is where you're talking of. It's 1315, exposure to dry heat, temperature 230 or 205, depending on the number of hours, correct? And then that next subsection allows you the methodology if somebody presents something new. I still come back to, I would never buy a used mattress, but why do we even allow them? And I remember from 07, we did have a few people from the industry, but what's bothersome to me is now there is no inspection, and I don't know that people would know who to even complain to. I'd want to know if a motel, for example, in my district purchased a bunch of used mattresses so that I, you know, and they should be able to post it saying, you sleep on a used mattress here. But be that as it may, there's just some things that could really undercut people, and they wouldn't even know really who to call.
Well, all the mattresses are required to be labeled. They'll say right on it. And
I watch them pick them up off the street when somebody puts them out, and they go in the back of a truck, and God only knows where they go after that part of it. So, and we did have a bed bug issue. We have to be very careful with our tourism industry.
Absolutely.
Especially in addition to that. I've never quite understood.
Well, the reg doesn't preclude us from doing spot checks.
Okay.
It just doesn't include a regular annual permit inspection type program. It's registration. It's similar to what the FDA does with their food facilities.
So how many businesses are out there then?
How would you say?
Would you guess?
That we have right now?
20. Yeah. Approximately 20 businesses.
Well, there's a lot more doing business and doing stuff with.
Well, those are the ones that are going to do this correctly.
That's why we have
can
here.
You, I'm sorry.
Could you identify yourself?
Yeah. Sorry, Dan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dan LaRubio.
Hold on, Dan.
Your mic's not on. Use this one.
That's one of the reasons we incorporated because of some of the public comment about what about all these other people are doing this. That's why we have the hearing officer process. So we will be using staff to respond to complaints of saying somebody's doing this out of a warehouse, and we can go out there and collect evidence and issue them an NOV and bring them before a hearing officer.
So they'd be an unlicensed business more than likely. So we'd have to make sure our business department, our code enforcement, and you all are linked up. I just think it puts it's risky for the general public, and I'm glad there's 20 good folks out there that will be registering with you, but there's probably hundreds undercutting that. And I just part of that, you can't overregulate, but I think I'm bothered that maybe we have to look at our codes to make sure our folks include that if someone gets a report, like if I get called as a commissioner or one of you get called as a council person saying, hey, I got bed bugs from this apartment complex or whatever, what is our process? And we should probably make sure our codes at least allow us some authority then to integrate with you all. But
right.
And I don't know if we...
Well, our main point, our desire was to come up with a regulation that wasn't onerous on industry, and it was cost-effective, but at the same time had a level of protection.
With 20 industries only registering, then I think you'd have the ability at least to annually inspect. But
We have the ability to annual inspect. We're just not saying we have to do an annual inspection.
Do you?
I think you should.
I think you should.
Just by the very nature of a hotel or a motel, you're sleeping on a used mattress, correct? I mean, they don't change the mattress every time they change the sheets. Is there anybody that monitors that, though? How long does a mattress get to stay in a hotel?
Well, it can stay there indefinitely, but when we do our inspections of public accommodations, they do examine the mattresses in every room that they inspect for damage, soil, occult staining. We use black lights on them.
This is a percentage of the beds in a particular public accommodation,
not all of them.
As a former maid, let me tell you.
More,
and I don't do my coroners well anymore.
We strongly encourage people to buy mattress covers, but since that's an initial expense, a lot of times they don't do that. And then they end up having to replace mattresses a lot.
And you can't cover everything in reg. I understand that. I just kind of give them
Paul, we feel the same way.
The heebie-jeebies.
Yeah.
Ms. Delaney is absolutely correct. There's no regulation as to how long any one hotel can keep a bed, how often they have to change them out. I don't think there'd be any way for us or anyone else to monitor that. And by definition,
after I have spent one night and you come in the next day, it's a used mattress. Yes. And I could have been the one to bring in the bed bugs. You would never do that, but I could have done
that. That's right. It would
and then,
be you.
And then you would be exposed to
that. But
them.
We don't vacuum your skin slough that comes off of, and that's a cleaning piece that the hotels really should be considering. Do hospitals have to retire their beds after a certain period of time?
Not that I'm aware
the
of.
The state doesn't state law preclude one from a hospital from being.
We can't use. We can't.
Nothing from a
hospital
can
bed.
Be put back into.
It can't be sold.
Do they have to? Do they have to get rid of them at like every 8 years or something like that?
I don't
think
so. I'm not unaware of
it
any
can't
regulations.
Be resold.
But you don't know how long they're able to use any one bed. I would suspect that there aren't any regulations related to how long anyone can use any.
Yeah, the only reason he mentioned hospital grade from CCD. You mentioned something
from CDC.
CDC.
Yeah. That was an un. That really
that's where
was
it burned
that,
it
that's
up.
That's complete removal of all vegetative.
But there
all
was nothing
spores.
In CDC standards for hospitals that you other than that sanitizing type thing.
Correct.
Okay.
And the 300 degrees was counterproductive.
It would not work for industry. That's
but it worked.
Yeah. Killed everything, including whoever was laying on it.
Sanitized. I hope nobody was. Yeah.
Do your inspectors ever go undercovers? No, never mind. Any additional questions from board members? Dr. Nemec?
Yeah. What pathogens had survived the previous cleaning protocol?
There has never been any testing actually done on used mattresses that we could ever find in regard to that. It was just a general standard. It was not something where they actually did testing to show whether or not. And we tried to find from California what the scientific basis for the their regulation was, and it has been in place since the 70s, and nobody could find it for us.
Well, I can't imagine there would be a bloodborne pathogen issue.
No.
And enteric pathogens usually don't survive. No. Long.
It's probably some spore forming.
So we were confident that quite essentially cooking temperatures that take pathogens, enteric pathogens out of food will take them out of a mattress as well. I'm fairly sure, confident that any viruses of concern would be deactivated at those temperatures.
The only thing I could think of potentially would be spore-forming bacteria or fungi, perhaps.
It may be the temperature just below with which combustion occurs.
Could be. It could be that they
and
combust.
And this is writing that line.
Mr. Dobine, is that good?
That's fine. So we have a new proposal that strengthens a protocol that probably was previously effective.
Yes.
But we're just meeting the CDC guidelines.
No.
Actually, no, we're not meeting CDC guidelines for sterilization. We're meeting.
But of course, sterilization wouldn't be the goal.
It wouldn't be the right appropriate protocol, correct? A mattress.
And brand new mattresses aren't sterile either, as you well know.
You take off the plastic.
Right.
Yeah. Or buy a memory foam mattress, which still isn't.
And our previous regulation, which was adopted back in 2007, was set aside and had not been enforced for a number of years. So right now, we have no regulation in force. So any regulation that we adopt is going to help us regulate and better than we are regulating right now in regard to mattresses.
Paul, can I say something?
Yes, sir.
We are very confident with the businesses that they'll go ahead and follow our regulations. We have had a lot of good feedback from them. I'm not concerned about them following the regulations. We've also heard from people who are selling mattresses out of storage units, like you've heard on the news, and they're not sanitized. They're not even cleaned at all. And now with the hearing officer process, we'll be able to bring them in and at least fine them so they'll stop doing what they're doing, which is a totally unhealthy situation right now for the public. We also have on our website, we explain to the public not to buy a mattress that doesn't have the labels, and we show the labels on the website, and we also show what these bad mattresses look like on the website. And so we hope to educate the public and bring them into an awareness that will eliminate some of these bad operators.
Mr. Chair, if I might just follow up with that. And that is somewhat closing the loophole. It would probably be good for us to know, I'd like to know what our, who registers so I can make sure our business license department knows about it. But then when you do website, not everybody has access to that. So maybe we should look at some kind of public service announcements or something to educate the general public broader and make sure that it's in Chinese, Mandarin mostly, Tagalog, Spanish, you know, so that you're covering the bases for people that might be more vulnerable to getting used products and not know to at least look for the tag and at least look for this type of thing. So maybe that's something, Jen, we could talk about. Years ago, the utilities used to put notices for folks in their utility messages, so maybe that might be something. Because it is a health factor, and
yes.
Just because you're impoverished doesn't mean you shouldn't be protected, too. So that might be something that to take a look at.
There's a regular order of business every month since my group of responsibility is food plan review, for instance, and swimming pool plan review. Every month I run a report that I send out to every jurisdiction's business license and building that shows what new applications came in that month and what ones were approved that month. So they have a list. And I've often gotten feedback, particularly from City of Las Vegas, saying, oh, never heard of that guy. So,
okay, good.
Got a lot of feedback going on back and forth between the business license.
If you're already doing that, then I'll just follow up with ours. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Mr. Devine, did you have a question?
And then just more of a comment.
Mayor Woodbury.
It does kind of concern me that we don't do any inspection, that we only react when there needs to be an investigation. Am I correct? That's what we're doing. We're not doing even an annual inspection on any of these places.
The amount of complaints that we receive is significant, and now we'll be able to investigate the complaints. We don't really need to investigate the good operators. We just need to investigate these bad operators that are feeding on the public. And we start a complaint investigation right from the first time we hear a phone call about it, and it's a process, an ongoing process that we take the people to bring them to compliance. Now with the hearing officer process, we'll take it even further. We'll send them an order the first time we go out to the site to cease and desist, and we're going to be back in 30 days. If they don't cease and desist, they're going to get a notice of violation, and then it'll be before the hearing officer. Hopefully this is going to deter the bad operators from continuing to feed on our public, our community.
Even do an initial inspection for their license approval.
I was just going to say that. Again, our regulations don't preclude us from doing that. So I was going to offer, as part of our procedures, to at least do an initial site visit to verify what's in their application.
We can do that.
I think that's our minimum due diligence.
Okay.
You all know, one of the speakers was Dan LaRubio, who's a registered environmental health specialist and an engineer. So just to identify him for those who don't know him.
Is there a method which one should report someone who is not on your list? I mean, because the things you're talking about are people that are being honest and filing for their license, and you could go inspect a facility. So is there some place where people could report the guy that's selling them out of the storage unit or the back of his truck?
We have a website for complaints. We have the 759-1000 number where they just follow the prompts and can make a complaint.
I agree with Chris on that one, though, that we might want to put that out there in several different languages because the website is likely to be in English. And if somebody has access to it, they need to be able to read English. We need to maybe do a little bit more outreach that if you see people doing this, that it needs to be reported.
Yeah, I would think that would be something that we definitely would want to do, at least as we actually ramp up a regulatory program, because really there is no regulatory program right now.
So, and some people may not even know they're doing something illegal.
And that's something we need to get out there to the public.
Well, you may want to put together a poster and give your registered operators copies of this poster for them to put up at places where they market, because that
sounds
would
good.
Seem to me a place where an unregistered operator might market as well.
Stores of
that's a great
stores,
idea. Thank you.
Okay. Sounds so great.
Dr. Eiser, I don't know if we had any
I think we're waiting for the public
hearing.
We're still
working through a backlog of board questions, and
okay.
Then we will have a public comment section.
So a couple of things. One, just preliminarily, this particular item didn't have any red lines or summaries in it either, at least on the iPad. And Mr. Klaus did a great job of explaining. So, I mean, I didn't really need it this time, but I think, you know, for all agenda items in the future, I would appreciate something like that, especially when we're considering changes. It just helps us to be able to ask questions about particular things and see them here on our screen. Or if you really want to waste the paper, you can print them out. It doesn't matter to me. But but on the subject of educating people, I think that that's a critical component of this. I'll just give you an anecdotal experience I had with this. A particular hotel in Boulder City, I know that the inspection process is occurring because it happened at one of the, our hotels out there. In fact, it's, if you look on TripAdvisor, it's our best hotel out there. Gets stellar reviews and things like that. But there was an inspection. I don't know if it was an annual inspection or just, you know, just a random inspection or anything like that. But, under black light, some stains showed up. And my issue at the time was not with the regulations, and I don't think the operator's issue was with the regulations. I mean, I think this particular operator wanted to comply. I think, you know, probably 99% of the operators do want to comply. There are always a few bad operators in any industry that are trying to evade the regulations. But in this case, that wasn't what was happening. But I was concerned about the process that happened and about the education aspect of it a little bit, and in part because stains showed up under black light. They were told, you know, within so many hours, like 4 hours or 6 hours, we're going to shut you down if you don't replace these mattresses. And so, you know, what ended up happening is, of course, they didn't want to get shut down. They hurried out and bought mattresses. Because of the time pressure put on them, they had to buy first mattresses they could find, which ended up being probably about two or three times as expensive as what they would have had to spend if they were given a little bit of time to go purchase them, or if they had been educated in advance. I'm not saying that was inappropriate to make them change the mattresses. I don't have personal knowledge of that, but I was concerned about the process. I think in general, our environmental health has gotten better at taking an education approach and sort of this kinder, gentler, let's help people comply rather than just punishing them for noncompliance. And I hope that that's the case with this program as well. But again, I think, you know, as important as the regulations themselves are, the process of educating people and then, you know, educating our inspectors as well to try to help people comply rather than just punishing them is really important, because again, I'm pretty confident that most people out there want to comply and they will if helped to do so.
And that was through our public accommodation inspection program. And as a result of that actual concern, we developed a protocol for staff that is much more specific as to what to do with what size of stain and what to recommend to operators and how better to approach them about it. We also would only ask them to take that particular room out of service. We would not shut down the entire facility. And I think maybe that was a miscommunication that occurred at that time as well.
And Mr. Woodbury, you know, you and I had conversations, and I brought Paul into the conversation, as I think you know. I think... You were the interim at the time, weren't you?
Yes, I think so.
So we brought Paul into that conversation. And you're right. I think that what I have tried to do, and certainly Jackie and Paul and Rose are trying to do, is to do kinder, gentler is one way of phrasing it. And I think what we want is compliance. And there are a number of ways to get compliance, one of which is carrots. One of which is sticks. And we have both of those and anything in between in our armamentarium. So I would prefer, and I think so would the staff prefer, the carrot approach. And I'll rephrase that as education, as you pointed out. So I think that is our approach pretty much across the board at this point. There are certain situations where we might not be able to do that, but even in the cases of illegal dumps, I think we try to do that first, where that's a little bit more harmful, perhaps to the environment and to water runoff. But we across the board, that's the approach that we're now taking. Am I correct?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I appreciate that, and I do compliment you on that. I've seen that in the restaurant industry and others. I think that's the appropriate way to do it, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
So I'm hoping I understood what you said. So there is a process in which if there's an inspection and certain biological stains are found on mattresses, that those mattresses are tracked and not able to be recycled?
They're marked.
Okay.
Yes.
And again, that doesn't have any bearing on this regulation. This regulation is for people to actually conduct resale and sanitation of mattresses, and that would be the public accommodation inspection process. Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just maybe a final wrap-up. I feel more comfortable knowing that now the bad actors have a process where you can actually summon them. Do you then automatically let the local jurisdiction know so we can also verify whether they've even bothered to apply for a license, a business license, and then that way you might have a double whammy that you could bring
definitely
up?
Something we need to incorporate okay. in there is keep that communication.
That would be great. Then I think that would be a good kind of just – it gives you more teeth actually before the officer if that's the case. Thank you.
Any additional board member questions? Then I will open this up for public comment.
We received an email today, so I'm going to act as if I'm Jack Campbell, who is the president of Walker Furniture. He writes to us this morning, "I regret that a situation came up preventing me from attending today's Board of Health meeting. Please extend to the board, Walker Furniture and related companies, appreciation for the change in attitude of the Southern Nevada Health District in providing procedures which will ensure public safety in an approach which business can fully support. When business and government work together, understanding each other's needs, there will always be workable solutions. Please feel free to reach out to me if I can be of any assistance."
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Any additional comments from the public? Okay, seeing none, I'll close the public hearing. Board, let's put this to bed.
Move approval. Okay.
Second. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good work.
Thank you very much.
He's always ready.
All right, that brings us to the end of agenda item 5 and to agenda item 6, reports and potential action and discussion. Sub 1, review and approve Nevada Resort Association nominations for at-large Board of Health member. Is that Dr. Iser going to make that?
I can do that. We, as you know, with Bill's resignation last month, we've been working with Virginia Valentine to get a list of nominations to bring forward to you. And I'll just read to you the letter that she sent to us, that it should be included in your package. "Dear Dr. Iser, as you know, Bill Noonan's resignation has created a vacancy in the industry seat on the Southern Nevada Health District Board. Nevada Resort Association Board of Directors recommends Scott Nielsen to fill the remainder of Mr. Noonan's term. Mr. Nielsen is currently the Executive Vice President and Chief Development Officer for Stations Casino. Mr. Nielsen is also an attorney and previously served on the LVCVA board in one of the NRA seats. He is very familiar with the Nevada open meeting law and local government issues in Southern Nevada. His intelligent and thoughtful approach will make him a great asset to the board." And then they give contact numbers for him. I'm not sure. I don't know who he is. Did Mr. Nielsen show up today?
No, not here.
No. So that is your nomination, and this is an action item if you choose to go forward with it.
Discussion, board?
Move for the approval of Mr. Nielsen.
Second.
We have a motion and a second to approve Mr. Nielsen as the NRA member on our board. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion passes.
And if I could ask you to direct me to contact him and tell him he's now a member of the board. We'll invite him to the next board meeting, and Jackie will swear him in at that time.
And ask him if he has any interest in serving on any of our committees.
We will. Okay. We'll be happy to do that.
6-2, review and or update Board of Health committees and committee memberships. Speaking of which, Dr. Iser?
Yes, sir. We sent out a survey to all of you, and we got several people who
volunteered to be on various committees, and what we have is the CHO Annual Review Committee, which would be next month, the at-large member selection, which would probably be in May or June of next year, the Finance Committee group that met just this week, and we'll hear a report from them soon, and the nomination of officers. You have in your packets the spreadsheet that shows who volunteered for those particular items. I believe that under your new regulations, you said that a minimum of 3 and a maximum of 5 can be on any one committee, although you could change that with another vote. For example, if Mr. Nielsen decides he wants to be on one of the committees that you have 5 of. So these are the people who have volunteered. You certainly can take additional volunteers at this meeting, and then I think we would like you to vote on who would be the members of the committees going forward.
Let's see. I would like to nominate Member June Kiliani for the 3 committees she's not, and Member Tarkanian for all 4 committees, since neither of them are here.
Member June Kiliani.
No, I withdraw those nominations.
Commissioner Scapp?
I thought I sent mine in. Sorry, but I will serve on the nomination of officers to fill that.
Thank you. Anybody else?
No.
Okay, let's add Commissioner Scapp to the nomination of officers committee. And we may appoint others as we see fit over the course of the year. Congratulations.
You're
on all the committees.
Because I went to the bathroom. Yeah. Oh, my God.
If you like, I can read very each committee up with the members that have self-nominated.
And you can into the record.
Okay. So on the CHO Annual Review Committee, members Beers, Dobine, June Kiliani, Nemec, and Woodbury have volunteered for that, and so you can take that as a single one, or I can read through the other 3 if you'd like.
Go ahead and read through all of them.
The at-large member selection, the people who have volunteered for that would be members Beer, June Kiliani, Mars, and Woodbury. Finance Committee, members Beer, Dobine, Mars, and Woodbury. The nomination of officers, members Beer, DeMine, Nemec, and Scow.
Mr. Chair, with the appointment of Mr. Nielsen, at some point do we allow them to say that I'd be interested? Okay.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Beer suggested that we contact him.
So I think I'd be looking for a motion to approve this set of committees and list of appointments to them, along with acknowledgement that we may well make adjustments to these committees over the course of the year.
That would be my motion.
Second.
Motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Motion passes.
Excuse me. Since there was no discussion, you would, Mr. Beers, you would automatically be chair of all these committees unless you appoint someone else.
When we prepare each subcommittee's agenda, let's have appointment of the chair.
Very good.
Be a standing agenda item.
Very good.
For each committee meeting.
Yeah.
I agree. We're happy to do that.
And that brings us, deja vu, to agenda item 6(1). I think that's a numbering error. I think that should be 3.
6(3), yes. We've done 1 and 2.
Yes. So,
with the 3-year budget projection.
Second set of 1 and 2 under agenda item 6, unless that was fixed on a later agenda.
It may be. My agenda shows.
I'm operating off my printed agenda. Okay. I have an earlier version of the agenda. I apologize. So 6(3), review and discuss 3-year budget projection.
Good morning. Sharon McCoy Huber, Financial Services Manager. On Monday, the Finance Committee met and we presented the 3-year plan to the Finance Committee. As you're seeing here in front of you, what we've done is we have updated the 2014-15, We've now made it one column where it shows unaudited figures. And as you can see in the yellow highlight, the change in fund balance for the 2014-15 fiscal year at the time this was prepared was projected to be a $1.6 million increase in fund balance, leaving the ending fund balance to be $13.5 million or 22.47% of expenditures. I want to commend staff and management for the good job they did this last year on holding expenditures down. They really stepped up to the plate. They understood the issues that were before us moving forward. They did a good job in presenting the 15-16 budget, but they also knew to hold the reins tight for the 14-15 year. So staff did a really awesome job, and I wanted to thank them for what they did. In the 15-16 year, currently the three-year projection still reflects the amount that was budgeted in March of 2015. The expenditures and revenues currently are remaining flat. The next time we do a presentation, the 2015-16 numbers will start fluctuating based on what is happening within the organization. We currently show a budget deficit, change in budget fund balance for the 15-16 fiscal year of $1.6 million, leaving the ending fund balance to be $11.8 million or 18% of the budget. And then when we projected out the 16-17 year and the 17-18 year, the changes that were made in those years, number one, there's projected to be a 3% increase in the tax revenues for each of those years. The expenditures are recommended to be going down, especially in the 16-17 year. We see that we've got a savings in lease payments of approximately $1.6 million beginning in fiscal year 16-17. And we'll also have additional savings in the 15-16 year. We put approximately $495,000 in the budget for scanning of paper into electronic version. And so that savings will be is reflected in the 16-17 year. We included in the 16-17 year as well as in the 17-18 year the step increases that are built into the contract for employees that have been here less than the number of years and they're still moving up steps. So that is minimal, but it is included in there. Also in the 16-17 year, you can see that we have a transfer to the capital fund of $350,000. That $350,000 we're projecting out. We're looking at feasibly purchasing a mobile clinic that we can use to reach our sites around the district. We are currently projecting our grants to be flat. We recently heard that one of our grants that was projected to be for 5 years is not going to be for 5 years. So that's why I said the numbers every time we do a presentation on three-year projections, they will be adjusting as we get information. That's pretty much it. If you see 16-17, we're projecting a change in fund balance of an increase of $200,000, which leaves fund balance at $12 million. In 17-18, a change in fund balance of $274,000. That is ending fund balance of $12.3 million. And if you look at the next slide, what that's pretty much projecting is that we're projecting out that we stay flat with our fund balance, and so we straight line. But I think the other thing that's important is that we're also projecting out a balanced budget in the future years. So with that, Dr. Iser, do you have any comments?
Sure. As you know, we presented this to the Finance Committee on Monday. We presented the same budget And the building update that you'll get in a few minutes to the supervisors and managers on Tuesday, as we always do before this meeting and these documents become public, the staff needs to know what's in them, in my opinion. Yesterday we had an all-hands meeting where we had all of the outstation personnel have access to either on their own screens or in their conference rooms this kind of information. Sharon did the presentation at all three of these and now the fourth one here. I always have to add, and I'll do that again today, that this is really assuming that things stay steady state. So you know that there are issues, international issues. So with Iran, and depending on what happens with that treaty, there may be significant disruptions in the international arena. That will affect us. The issue with what's going on in China now seems to have stabilized in terms of how it has affected our stock market, but that could cause problems in the long run at any time, as we well know, any of us who are over the age of 40 have seen a couple of downturns over our lifetimes. There are the other issues, and Sharon referred to one of these. The Pitch Grant was originally scheduled for 5 years. CDC has now told us it'll only be 3 years. So when that grant comes to an end, unless we have other grants, we will lose those grant dollars. And as you can see from here, we don't have the 80-10 dollars to be able to pick up all that we were doing before. As I mentioned to staff yesterday, all of our grant programs are always at risk. So there are competitive grants, for example, for family planning that could go to another organization. Our immunization grant could be cut. Our other clinical grants could be cut. And in fact, some people are projecting that some of those will be, as what's happened with the Pitch Grant. There are a variety of other grants, small and large, that we will be trying to apply for. We've been relatively successful over the last year and a half. That has really added how many millions of dollars to our budget?
Approximately $5 million.
Approximately $5 million on an annual basis. But again, once we lose the Pitch Grant, that will go down. So we're always on the lookout for other grant opportunities. So there are lots of caveats to put in here. You all know this. Those of you who represent your jurisdiction know these kinds of things as well and know that your budget could be impacted by any of these same things. So with that, we would open this conversation up to questions. I think the one thing to add, though, is Sharon pointed out the $350,000 for 16-17, and what we really want to do is to be mobile and be able to go, in particular in North Las Vegas and in Henderson and probably in the southwest corner of the valley, where we know that we may not be meeting all the need where we're currently located and should be located. And I would prefer to not see us go into 10-year leases, 5-year leases. If we can buy a van, that really is cost-effective. So if you look at what we have been paying up in North Las Vegas, that's about $70,000 a year. That's a payback of very quickly 5 years or so. What we're paying in Henderson as that lease expires, we'd get the payback in less than a half of a year if we can go out to community centers where we know the need is. Our CHA, our community health assessment, will give us an idea of where, a better idea of where those needs are, and that's how we would like to be flexible and mobile and helpful to all the jurisdictions. Part of the county are places where we don't have lots of personnel. The only place we do, I guess, in the county is in East Las Vegas right now.
Committee, I don't know if any of you serve on the Regional Transportation Commission. I do not, but I serve on the Workforce Connections Board, and they got a van from the RTC at a very significant discount that they were then able to build out into a mobile jobs response unit. So that may
we're
be
open to that.
An alternative.
Yeah, I'm on that, and all you need to do is send a letter to Tina quickly or MJ, and they can put you on the list, and as they have vehicles that come available,
we'd be happy to do that.
Sizes. But I think they're changing out their fleet. So some of them had diesel, which you have to look at, but I don't remember what all.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Right, we would be excited about that. It has to be adjustable, of course, blackout windows and so
right.
on. I've told you before that in one of my counties in another state, we had this, and we went to very rural parts of the state, and we took an eligibility worker with us. Of course, this is California, and eligibility is determined by the counties, not by the state there.
for all county programs. So we were able to take someone from the county with us on all of these.
What did they ever do with the Cal buses and the Smiles? For, I mean, remember that?
Mystery buses, yeah.
Yeah, they had decked them all out. I wonder if the university still had them because they were parked over on their campus.
We'll look throughout our partners. You remember at our retreat that we had in December, we talked about this as one of our goals, and we've decided to go forward with it because of the very expensive leases that we've been in that really has put us in the blue part of this chart. I think the last thing to say, if I may, is that I promised you that we would do our best to balance the budget in 3 years, and we've done it, it looks like to me. And I can share Sharon's appreciation to the staff, in particular to working with the union on our last union contract, and in keeping requests to a reasonable, affordable amount for us. We'll be going to negotiations again for salaries and other financial benefits in a year, less than a year and a half from now. We'll be working with them on that as well. But it's due to the sacrifices that the people in front of you, and I mean all the way to the back of the room and people who may be listening at their desks, have gone through in order to get us to where we are.
Sure. Any questions, board? Let's start down with this, Commissioner Jim Kiliani.
Thank you. Just remind me, the proprietary fund is generated from where?
The proprietary fund is the lab fund.
The lab, okay. And that still exists over on the Shadow campus?
Yeah. Okay. It's on Desert.
Behind. Yeah, that's another building that we own. We did hire a new laboratory director for a variety of reasons that I'd be happy to go into detail about. She will be bringing a level of expertise that we've not been able to gain through our agreement with UNR and the public health lab up there. And so we're looking forward to...
I always felt we could generate revenue from doing some testing down here, especially for some of the hospitals, because we were sending stuff out to Oregon, yes. Not even just northern Nevada. So I would hope that we'd still be looking at
that. We're looking at that. Dr. Lockett, I think that Dr. Carifa was here. Okay, but we're already bringing online chlamydia and gonorrhea within the next couple of weeks, Bonnie? Within the next couple of weeks that we've been sending out, mostly to Long Beach and most recently to Quest. And then we're planning to start doing our own TB testing, mm-hmm. hopefully by the end of this year, maybe by the end of this calendar year, hopefully before that. And we'll be marketing some of these services to other not-for-profits.
Absolutely. UMC might be interested.
It might be.
I'd be talking to Mason and see if there's some potential.
I've already talked to Mason. I've had a meeting with him.
Second question was going to be about the grants, and you mentioned the pitch grants. But I can't remember. Do we have grant writers within our departments or not? Yes?
No. I'm sorry. I interrupted you. We have people who are experts that we always will have to have to inform any grant writer. We do have Linda who, for those of you who have been, and I know you've been, Mary Beth, you've been also to the CHIP meeting, and so you saw her lead that CHIP meeting, that she does some grants for us as well. We're trying to determine whether we should or could afford a full-time grant writer when we can contract it out. But we certainly need people, and that's our own staff generally, who would be researching and looking for grant opportunities throughout the federal government. We get the letter from Senator Reid that has a lot of stuff. The Regional Health Administrator, who's a U.S. Public Health Service Commission officer, sends something out every month. When I see stuff in that, I send it out to staff to determine whether it's something we want to do.
Your frontline people know best. I would say they'd say, hey, this one we can go for, we could qualify for. But then having taken the time to have someone write it, and maybe contracting that part out make sense. The university used to do some assistance. I don't know if they do. But I don't know if we partner with other groups that maybe Volunteers in Medicine's writing a grant and you all can write a grant together and somehow share funds. I just don't know. I mean, that those are some things that we ought to explore if we haven't explored
that part. We do. We've talked to Sean Gerstenberger about writing grants with him. I had a meeting with Health Insight just this week where we hope to write grants. He's also part of the CHIP
meeting and the representative, and that we would hope to write grants with them. So we will partner, and we're looking at co-locating potentially with a not-for-profit community-based healthcare organization as well. So where we can, we will always do that.
And then budgetarily, accreditation always costs money. So what is the final impact of the cost of the accreditation to date?
To date would be Demetria just resigned about a week ago, but we would have a salary which is Andy?
Just over
$70,000 a year. When we apply for accreditation, it's about $7,000 a year, so I think it's $35,000 when we actually apply and get accreditation. And that's probably a year and 3 months from now?
Correct.
Approximately a year and 3 months from now.
And then sometimes with accreditation, it's also the staff time that should be factored in, not just a person dedicated, because every department's going to have to do something. So I think that we should at least, bless you, factor that in so we're aware of it, and then what potential cost impacts, bless you, could come in addition to that, because sometimes it's changed as protocol and that costs money. You have to go buy new equipment, or you have to do training or something along those lines. And I think we have to be cognizant of that, because what I appreciate that we balance the budget in 3 years. I had concerns when we first set that as a goal, not because I didn't think it was prudent, but because the incline or the downturn really did impact all of local governments, and we haven't been able to really – this will be the first year we're actually hiring anybody in the county. And I don't want program to be put at risk just because we set a number for a budget. And I think that that's got to be something that we still take a look at, because you're hands-on. It's a health and safety issue. It's not like if I send out five more inspectors to look at cars in the county. It's far more important than that. And so I would just hope that we're cognizant that as you decide where you cut, sometimes you're cutting very integral pieces of delivering services to our constituents. And so that's always been a concern that I've continued to have. I understand about the downturn, and I see that you've lowered your budget projections down to about 18% for your ending fund balance. What did we change those numbers, or did we only talk about that?
We did change them. The previous board requirement was 16.6%. And then at our recommendation, because we put aside that $1 million, we cut it to
10%.
I think I'll speak for senior staff here, is that I feel much more comfortable where we are at this point in going forward.
Personally, it's more prudent. I didn't necessarily agree with the 16%, but that was the way
I agree. We just didn't think we would. And you gave us permission actually this year to go below go below that amount. Maybe it was last year, and we didn't. So we now look stable. We don't have funds to expand unless we get additional grant funds. We don't have enough 80-10 dollars to do all the things we would like to do, but we don't foresee any significant cuts at all unless some of those things happen that I just outlined for you for the foreseeable future.
And then finally, HIV AIDS, has that funding been cut, or has that been reduced at all from the
No, I don't government? Believe so. I think
state that we've had about the same.
I think we've had about the same. Is that correct, Bonnie? I don't think we've had any cuts. Yeah, I don't think we've had any cuts at all in that.
It's my understanding we did, and so I would ask that we would look at that, because community-wise we still have some issues there, and I think the center was actually going to look at possibly co-locating something with you all to provide some services.
We already are co-located with them. We have people who go out and draw bloods and do testing at the center right now, and have been since I've
been
here. Okay,
what days? I usually go – that's right down the street from me.
I think it's every day. Whenever I've been over there, I've seen our people there. That doesn't mean that every day they have it.
Right.
And at the boxing ring –
Richard Steele.
Oh, Richard Steele.
Yeah, we have people that go up there too. And we're happy to partner with anyone.
I staff that site. I actually work that site. It's Monday through Thursday, 10:30. Till 5.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I know I've seen you there.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Giorgio?
Obviously, it's my second meeting over here, and I'm very happy to be here, still getting my sea legs. The issue of the clinic in North Las Vegas, my colleague, of course, Councilwoman Wood, kind of brief me a bit on that. I know the location. I know where the location was. Matter of fact, it was in my ward, right off of Craig. Not the appropriate time to discuss that, but that is a great concern to us in North Las Vegas. And I'm going to bring it up not as a feeling of being a stepchild in the valley. That isn't how I feel about it. It's just how do we correct that need that's there, whether it be in a mobile fashion or you know,
that's
bring me up to speed at the appropriate time.
Yeah, can I spend 2 minutes? We had a meeting with Dr. Liu wasn't there, but her staff was, and Ms. Wood was there, Anita was there, and we talked about various options. We looked out the window from that conference room, and we saw where I think it's Nevada Health Centers has a center, and then there's another center there. And about two blocks away is where we were considering trying to do four walls, and it doesn't make sense to do that. We looked at who the vaccines for children's providers are in that area, and it's kind of inundated right there. So it seems to me that we ought to look at where the need is and be able to use a mobile van to go to address that need. And that need could change from year to year as the economy continues to recover in various areas. And we do have the systems in place to look at the community health assessment to see where those areas are throughout the county, actually, the cities and the county. So that's what we would propose doing. Believe me, you are not a stepchild. We provide plenty of services to North Las Vegas residents at both East Las Vegas and at our site here. And we have Nurse Family Partnership and our other outreach programs going into the community and meeting with the people who need our services up there, too. So no one is a stepchild. And I know Mr. Woodbury knows this. The only place the only incorporated area that we don't have a clinical presence is in Boulder City. We don't have a clinical presence in Laughlin, which isn't incorporated, but we do send people down there as we need to. We'll be changing our location there. Ms. Scow, Ms. June Kelliani, I think you may know that we'll be moving into that county civic complex there, which will provide us some benefits, you some benefits, and we'll look at providing, as we need to, clinical services down there. So we do want to get into other areas that we know are needy. I mentioned the Southwest area. So I think that we just need to look at our data and work with your appointed officials as best we can to determine where best we can go. My guess is that there are going to be a couple of community centers in the areas where we need to go or some other facility that we can go to up there. And take
well, I, you know, personally speaking from my constituents in my ward and hearing the other wards, more of the mature part of town, you know, I could support the mobile unit concept. And I don't feel like we're stepchildren over there either, so I want to clarify that. You know, this is just about providing services to our people, regardless of where they are in the valley.
We believe me, we fully agree with you. And I think you've been here 2 months, and I would hope that other board members could appreciate and apprise you of the fact that we really are trying to do as much outreach as we can.
I know that. That's it for me.
Okay, thank you. Anybody on the side questions on the presentation?
Actually, just want to reiterate my comment from the committee meeting is I really do think it is important that we look at having a full-time professional grant writer. I think that, and I don't want to take away from what we're doing now and the quality of the work, but it is a turn of a phrase. It is the way something is formatted that can make all the difference in the world. And when we get accreditation, a whole new world of grants opens up for us. And the cost of a grant writer in Clark County is not that significant for a good one. As I said, the Las Vegas Municipal Court just hired their own because they saw the value of it, and I think that's something we seriously should consider
maybe
here.
Maybe they won't gouge our constituents with partner rates. Muni, never donate.
I hear some mumbling over to your far left.
Let me turn my hearing aid up. What was that, Chris?
I made a snide comment that maybe the Muni courts then will stop gouging our constituents.
Well, I would tell you she's a very good grant writer. I actually know her personally.
I do have a few questions. As I'm looking at the expenditures for this year going forward, you know, we went up about $5 million to $65 million, and going forward, it looks like we're leveling off at about that amount. You know, our revenues are higher as well, going up to $68 million next year and the following year. But you had said earlier that we're potentially losing the pitch grant. Does that account for that? Or?
No. At the time that this was prepared, we were unaware that that was stopping, and so this currently does not reflect that. But the next time we roll out the three-year projection, which the goal is quarterly, those types of things will be reflected, so you will see the reduction in revenues and then some reduction in expenditures, but it won't be a one-for-one because the goal would be to keep the soft costs here, which are would end up the tax dollars would end up having to absorb that cost. And so consequently, the impact could reflect in a negative change in fund balance.
A significant amount of the pitch grant goes out into the community, and that's, of course, what we would have to cut if we don't have the funds to do that.
Right.
Right. And how much, remind me how much that was and when the sunset was?
$2.5 million is the pitch grant, and my understanding was that it was going to stop in September of 2016.
That's probably correct. We're in the second year of three if we don't get an extension beyond that time, or additional grants don't become available for us to apply for.
Right. So that $2.5 million goes away, but you're saying maybe not $2.5 million in expenses.
Because the goal would be, especially like the staffing cost, because we would want to keep, the goal would be to keep the program active, but it would be try and keep as much of the staffing cost that we could. The hard dollars, the contracts with other entities would feasibly fall off.
And we don't see any other major grants on the horizon that are going to add significantly to our fund balance?
Cass is Lockett, Director of Community Health. So the pitch grant, as Dr. Iser indicated, approximately 50% goes out to the community. The reduction level is basically equates to salaries in 80-10. So the savings we get from that grant is approximately $500,000. So that's the reduction you would expect.
Mm-hmm. And then if I'm looking down at it looks like these other funding sources are pretty much staying flat too, except the transfer to the proprietary fund, which is the lab fund, right?
Correct.
So we're expecting our expenses there to go up by about $500,000 in the next 2 years?
Our expenses from the tax dollars to go up. Currently, the current fiscal year we're in is drawing the last of their reserves down to zero. And then in the future years, the tax funds would fund it at 100% instead of them having reserves.
Okay.
Although we do get significant grants that go into the proprietary fund, too. So we get money through Public Health Emergency Preparedness, another grant called ELC, which is something laboratory epidemiology and laboratory capacity. So we put some of those dollars in to that fund as well.
Okay, but our costs there aren't changing. It's just the source of the funds? Or?
The source of the funds. The cost for future years, we're going to analyze and look at those as we come on. And also the other thing that's not in there is as we take on the new sampling and testing that the lab does, hopefully we'll start generating revenues in the lab fund that we historically have not done in the past.
Okay. So assuming the pitch grant goes away and we don't get other funding sources, other grants or other funding sources, then potentially, we're looking at an ending fund balance that looks about $2 million worse than this or $1.5 million worse than this?
It would be more like $500,000 worse than this.
Okay. And that's, again, because we wouldn't be providing those funds to our partners. We wouldn't have them. And currently, that grant covers 40%, 50% of many salaries, so only about half of the salaries. And to be honest, that's how we'll have to choose how to use our $80-10 dollars best.
Is that going to mean a reduction in jobs at all if we lose that grant?
We plan not to do that at all, but we can't promise anything because, as I've said to you before, the loss of grants, really, we can't
backfill that with $80-$10 dollars and keep a balanced budget. So we really need to work on getting additional grants to cover these salaries, as we would if we lost the immunization grant or if we lost the STD grant. We would either have to downsize or find other funds to support that activity.
Okay. And then the transfer to building fund of the 1.3, is that based on some particular formula? Is it just our hard costs that we'll have in the new building, or what?
Currently, it was based on a formula of 1/14 of the tax revenue about 2 years ago. What we want to do is, in fiscal year 16-17, start reexamining that amount. Currently, we're using it for the renovations that we're doing to the building at Decatur. And probably in the future, after we know that where we are going infrastructure-wise, the recommendation would be based on putting an amount in there to cover annual depreciation, because you always want something to backfall on for future expansions that you would need in future years. So I would recommend that we would keep putting money in those funds, but maybe not at that level in the future.
And that's what we discussed with the Finance Committee as well. We do have the two buildings, so we have to worry about renovations. We have to worry about HVAC. We have to worry about the systems that support those buildings.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, and I want to compliment you. What a great job you've done over the last 2 to 3 years. I agree that we've made substantial progress. I understand it's a fluid process. I mean, this is just a snapshot. Every time we see it, it's just a snapshot, and it's always changing. I think Member DeBine's point is a good one. I don't know if that's, you know, the only solution to getting more grants, but clearly, I mean, grants are the lifeblood of what we do, and we need to find newer and better ways to get more of those grant funds, and so want to make sure we're constantly working on that.
I think a comparison to most health districts or departments around the country, most of them get 50% of their operating funds, more or less, from tax revenues somehow. Usually it's a county appropriation, or where there's a city health department, a city appropriation. We get about 25% of our funds from the taxes that we receive for property taxes from all of you. So we start out at a disadvantage, and we're more at risk because of grants and the fees that we charge. And I think we've mentioned this a couple of times in the past, but it's always a good reminder, I think, that that does put us at higher risk.
Thank you.
Got another question, Doug?
No,
okay. Any additional questions, committee? The agenda item 4 is to receive the report and accept the recommendations from our Finance Committee meeting on Monday. At that meeting, the Finance Committee moved and approved to accept this report.
I would make that motion, Mr. Chair, to accept the report.
And I'll second it.
We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good work. That brings us to agenda item 7, board reports. The Southern Nevada District Board of Health members can identify emerging issues here that we would like staff to address or to be taken up by the board in future meetings and direct staff accordingly. Comments made by individual board members during this portion of the agenda will not be acted upon by the Southern Nevada District Board of Health unless that subject is on the agenda and scheduled for action. Any board member comments at this time? I have one. I would like the board to consider at the next meeting to have a presentation on the decision on replacing the chief nurse with a non-nurse. It seems a pretty significant policy change, and I don't fully understand it myself. So I don't know if other board members share that sentiment and have a desire to see that put on our agenda for the board's approval next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo that, and I think it'd be good if we could see a copy of what was posted, because I thought when we had this conversation, it was somewhat implied from the board that we expected a nurse, and especially since the state law does require that. So as long as the agenda item doesn't preclude us from doing anything different by its timeliness or not.
the positions are different positions. The CMO position is not the position that we're advertising. This is the director of clinical services. So it's not the same position that we discussed last month, so you know.
Okay. But I'd still believe a nurse should be in those positions, so thank you.
And like I said, there's a fundamental change here, maybe driven by outside factors and changes in the overall delivery of healthcare in America. That's just seems to me like it's pretty big, and I'd like to get a better handle on it.
I agree. I would like to hear, be educated on it at least.
Sure. Any other board comments? Okay. Y'all sound bored. Time now for agenda item 8, health officer and staff reports, starting with our CHO comments.
I don't have too much more than what are in my written comments. We do have a meeting coming up with the infection control managers from all of the hospitals, and one of the issues that we'll want to discuss with them would be antibiotic stewardship, which includes really the broad agenda item of what antibiotics are physicians using for which infectious diseases and how best to choose those antibiotics. That's sort of the layperson's description of what it is. We do plan on doing what we call an antibiogram, which is looking at the resistance patterns in the hospitals. That's a discussion that Mason is...
Say it again.
Antibiogram. So it gives you an idea of the resistance patterns, in particular in hospitals, due to various infectious organisms, E. coli, for example, Pseudomonas, and a variety of others. So that's a discussion that we're having with the infection control managers, and it's on the agenda for our hospital advisory board, our facilities advisory board as well. And at our next facilities advisory board, which is maybe in a month or so, we will be discussing, and we will have invited the mental health hospitals to join that board. So that would give us a more robust discussion on mental health issues throughout the valley.
Question. What mental health hospitals?
You know, I don't have the name.
I'm thinking WestCare.
WestCare. There are several of them. WestCare, I know, is one of them.
Most of them went out and left us because they were making more of a profit to
Ross
put in
and
rooms now, or some are coming back in. So
Ross and Neal
would be another. Because I think a few of the others started to add a wing or
I
two.
I thought somebody added
Yeah, they're
a wing.
Already represented. So
okay.
Valley
so this
Hospital
is...
added a wing for mental health. So they're already represented
on
that. So the hospitals that have wings related to mental health already are represented on this board or invited to participate in the board.
And then antibiogram, does that have to do with MERS then when you get into hospitals?
It would be.
MRSA.
Yeah, it would look at the resistance patterns to a variety of organisms. So one of the things when I was in medical school in Dr. Nemec, you can correct me, but probably when you were in medical school too, for a urinary tract infection due to E. coli, it was ampicillin, and that was the curative agent. It isn't anymore. So over time, because of misuse, overuse, inappropriate use of antibiotics by not just physicians, but also by veterinarians, we see resistance patterns emerging, and the newer antibiotics are far more expensive. So by taking – and actually the Nevada State Medical Association wants to take this on as an issue too, but we can be a leader in that because we have most of the hospitals down here that we would like to discuss with them. And with the Clark County Medical Society, the antibiotic stewardship, how best to use antibiotics in
so
a clinical situation.
So I believe we passed a law that you have to – the pharmacies have to report to the State Pharmacy Board meds that are distributed. And especially so you can look at contraindication and something along those lines. But would you not be able to see which, with no disrespect, docs or whatever might be right over prescribing?
No, you have to look at the resistance patterns as they develop in hospitals. So one hospital in one region can be different from another hospital in the same region, let's say Southern Nevada, and can be quite different. From here to Northern Nevada can be quite different to Phoenix. Will likely be very different to New York City because of the emergence of resistant organisms that oftentimes are geographical.
Over time, though, and especially with the misuse and the overuse of antibiotics in our veterinary system and in our food system, antibiotics for cows, antibiotics for livestock in general, for chickens, that those resistance patterns really help to push us to research and find additional antibiotics that are good for the same organism.
Oh, chickens. So when we bring in, we get complaints through code and we take them down to Animal Foundation, do you all test to make sure that they've even had their shots?
Animals, no. That's not in our...
Wow. I wonder who would make sure. I mean, because you got people abusing that all over. I may have to look into that one.
Yeah. Now, the FDA looks into that.
They don't look at
crap. But we don't. But we don't.
It's kind of when you're dealing with that Department of Ag, none of them really do it. But if you do, sometimes we bring in 100 chickens from a phone call because it was illegal in the zoning and whatever, and I hadn't even thought about them not even having their antibiotics or their shots to make sure that they're not resistant, because that could affect other animals once they're brought into the foundation. Okay, I'll have to look into that. And are you going to talk at some point about Nye County Hospital closing, if there's been any impact on the jurisdiction?
I can. Richard Whitley, of course, sent us out a note that the hospital in Tonopah has closed, and the direct impact to us is virtually zero to none. The hospital that's right next to Washoe County, Pershing County, I believe, has offered to provide some emergency services down there. They're trying to beef up some urgent care services down there, but it's far enough away that it does impact us. If Pahrump had closed, that would impact us much more. I did write to Richard and told him that if there's any way that he can see, or Nye County can see, that we can be helpful, we would like to reach across county lines to be helpful. I don't see any direct service needs that we would have to do at this
point. The health district, but do you know if any of our other hospitals might be impacted? I thought I read that in the articles.
I had not seen that, but it's very likely to be true. People have to be hospitalized. From Tonopah, they're as likely to go north as they are south, because that's about half the way here.
I think Hawthorne would be closest.
Hawthorne would be closest, but I don't know what their status is anymore.
They have a transfer agreement with Bishop, Pershing, Bishop,
okay.
Vegas.
Bishop would be closer, actually,
Bishop.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, if Pahrump goes out of business, that will definitely impact us, and will impact not just our hospitals, but will impact us, too.
Thank you.
Okay, any additional questions? Okay, then let's move on to the program overview, floods and public health, environmental health consequences, and the role of environmental health.
I had one item that... Ms. Bradley asked me to say,
please. I'm sorry.
It's not
my fault.
I'm from
the city, and we rarely get accused of moving too quickly. You caught me.
And you're faster than the county.
I've been in a car behind you. I know better. It says, please remind the board to submit your advisory board appointments. I think I know we have someone from Boulder City. And I think you said just now that we'll get it from Mesquite. We'll get the board appointment. I don't think we have one from North Las Vegas. And
we had two.
Don't have Henderson.
Potential candidates, but it turned out they both lived just over the line in the county.
That's correct.
That was our problem.
Right.
We had to find
so if y'all need candidates.
Do we have any, Mary Beth?
We're not in the law.
Oh, we're not in the law. That's right. So if you have your two people that qualify, we could... Let us know who they are, and then we could at least get them into the mix.
Bless them in.
We can bless them in, since they're city-county kind of folks.
I don't want to raise the annexation word. Anyway.
Do you want to annex the county? That's big.
You're welcome to it.
just the little part where the doctor works or lives. Anyway, okay. Consider us reminded, and now on to item 8, second bullet point.
Jackie Rezitar, Director of Environmental Health. And for the sake of time, I'll make sure that we can get through these slides pretty quickly. But I wanted it to be kind of fun, interactive, and show you kind of a show-and-tell piece that will bring to light how much we are proactive and we protect the environment. Slides.
Who's doing the slides for you?
I guess I could.
Yeah. So, your mouse is right there.
I guess I just assumed they would pop up, huh?
How much handout?
Is this yours right here?
And they have the handouts.
Okay.
Which one? Which presentation is yours? This one?
That looks like it.
Right there. Sorry.
Sorry.
Okay, so the purpose of today's presentation is to provide insight as to significant public health dangers and the role of Southern Nevada Health District. You can go to the next one. Health Division during the flood season. As you know, it is flood season, and there are many public health dangers that are involved. And the most important part is for you to understand the role of Southern Nevada Health District, the Environmental Health Division, our role in making sure that we protect and have a proactive concept to prevent diseases in the community. Next. Southern Nevada flooding, as you know, most residents here know that the weather is very dry and the regions are very extreme. And then at any given moment, we can have intense rainfall that creates flash floods. The most damaging storms happen between July and September. Last year, we worked with MOAPA and we worked with Laughlin this year to help communicate and rectify flooding concerns and public health dangers. The local burdens, as you know, include private property owners, damage to their property, public facilities, loss of environmental or commercial businesses, the increase of public health costs due to the onset of illness, and, of course, the whole impact to the entire community, to the economy. Nevertheless, to mention the dangerous roads and the infrastructure that come into play that might include deaths as well as dangerous travel. Next slide. So the number one public health danger that I want you to be aware of is the contamination of water supplies. The overwhelming floodwaters impact our drinking water supply in the sewer system, and whoever is swimming in there is probably not the smartest person because there are a lot of issues in that water, such as human feces, animal feces, urine, chemical pollutants such as oil, gasoline, and antifreeze. And then these foul waters, of course, flow into the homes, recreational areas, wells, and neighboring communities. Next slide. Again, public health dangers include sewage backup and plumbing and or basements. I don't know how many of you residents have witnessed floating issues in your basement through floods. The water intrusion also produces toxic mold after a long period of time in ceilings, walls, and insulation.
Wrong state.
Another important issue is the waterborne disease outbreak potential. There's hundreds of types of disease-causing bacteria, viruses, and parasites that cause a high rate of gestational symptoms such as nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. And these are some of the potential public health dangers that we're faced with. Giardia, it's an intestinal parasite. Cryptosporidium is a parasite. Hepatitis A, when you ingest contaminated waters, it can inflame the liver. Leptospirosis is a bacteria transmitted through or by animal urine. So when animals urinate in the water, the leptospirosis, if you go back just one real quick, kind of a worm-like bacteria. Causes gestational or gastrointestinal illnesses. Next slide. And, of course, just to show you the public health dangers of the waterborne diseases, how they do impact the digestive system. Next slide. And here's the meat and the potatoes, the role of environmental health. When we have floods, the proactive approach for environmental health is to ensure that food operations, vector control, and solid waste provide education on a routine basis. So we want to prevent the impact of waterborne illnesses or other factors that can affect the environment. So one of our prevention to impact is our routine surveillance and our routine inspections. So with food, of course, we're out there on a mandate once a year to make sure that food operators understand what to do and how to react during floods. So our communication is prevalent before, during, and after. So food operations, we discuss food safety and risk communication measures to help eliminate issues of using ice during boil water advisories. We did witness one time in Laughlin where they were thawing meat under water that was deemed unsafe. So for us to be proactive and get out there on site immediately really helps eliminate dangers. And vector control. This is the most awesome part of the presentation.
Where are my fish? Our fish. These little guys, Paul, can you pronounce the name of it?
Gambusia?
Gambusia. So when we do our site surveillance, we're also looking at floodwaters and pooling of water that could potentially breed mosquitoes. So these little guys, the mosquito fish, I know we've mentioned them before. We actually raise these here. And this is a cost-effective measure to eliminate mosquitoes and the onset of West Nile virus and or malaria. But West Nile virus is prevalent here in Southern Nevada, so that's what we're most concerned with. But I'll pass this to you, and you can actually see what we raise here. And we also work closely with Clark County to identify areas and to place these awesome little fish in the ponds of water.
I have a question.
Yes.
Once you put them in, do they live or do they not reproduce? Do you have to keep putting them in, or
they do well reproduce?
Okay.
So you create a colony that mm-hmm. continues on.
Right. As long as the standing water maintains.
And then it dies out. That was going to be my question. Then it dies out because there's no water for them to live in. Because you want to look at other environmental issues. I mean, if you look at Australia when they brought in the frogs to eat the whatevers, and
right.
and now they're like flying rats, which I call pigeons. But you know, outside of that, you just want to make sure you don't create another downstream, so to speak.
We'll problem. Put them in stagnant water in ponds. We won't put them in a water course.
I see.
Okay.
So you can see in the photo the mosquito larvae, the fish actually eat the larvae, and then we prevent, hopefully, a mosquito that has West Nile virus.
And if I can point out, this is a perfect form of primary prevention where you can see what will happen if you don't intervene and you prevent something from happening because they eat the larvae before they emerge as adults.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Now, when we were talking before the meeting, you were saying that you put these also in, like, pools when somebody has reported a green pool or whatever. Do you put signage up that says this pool has these fish in it? Please don't pour your chlorine in here. I mean, because you said that thing kills the fish, so it's kind of.
We have not, but when we add the fish, we can add signs.
I mean, it just makes sense to let the neighbors know we're trying to – don't add chlorine. Don't try to take care of this problem. We're addressing the issue.
And that's a great point. When we get to that, we can implement that as well.
Yeah, no fishing. Yeah,
no fishing.
Often we don't have access, particularly in residential, so we'll just report it to the code enforcement, and code enforcement will go pump it dry
right. So
that we don't have the issue.
I think the county also raises these fish, too. So
they do.
In fact, I think that's how we. I'm sorry.
Where?
I don't know where the county.
I know we
actually over over water reclamation.
Probably, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or
and
by the
we raise them as well.
I got to ask. Okay, so where are they raised here?
That's what I said.
Actually, over in the compound at the Shuttle Lane complex, we have two small. I believe they're around 250-gallon tubs. That we raise them in, just an aerator and a shade cover.
And we'll be bringing those over to the new building.
We will, yes.
Once we vacate the county site there.
So they reproduce rather quickly then.
Mm-hmm. And they're very effective in eliminating mosquito larvae.
They're adorable, wouldn't you see?
They're cute.
They're cute.
Most critters in the picture.
So to move on from vector control,
your
proactive measures, just want to alert you to what solid waste does as proactive measures to help eliminate.
Sorry.
I'm not going
to
sleep
anymore. We went back
anymore.
To bed bugs, and we thought, well, maybe we could do
won't sleep anymore. He's fishing
spiders.
Anymore now.
What are you
spiders?
Spiders.
So as far as solid waste.
If we can, we'll proceed.
So as far as solid waste, what we do as a proactive measure is we conduct our solid waste audits. That prevents any or helps to prevent stuff that goes into the wash. So when we have a flood, we don't have extra oil, antifreeze, gasoline floating into these floodwaters. Also sewer response. We do emergency sewer response throughout the city when we get the calls. And this helps us guide and correct participants, if you will, clean the area well enough so we don't have more and more solid waste issues that go into the wash. Also illegal dumping complaints. The more illegal dumping complaints we address, the less chance we're going to have big piles of rocks, sticks, whatever, debris that can go into the washes to accumulate more floodwaters. Next. So our communication, we work with the state, local agencies, and then SNHD, and that's just a round-the-clock type of concept. There's not one order that goes into play, so we want to make sure that the issues are handled almost immediately.
Do you interact with the city's emergency management response group, as what cities being IES apostrophe, not just mine, but all of them?
Yes, we do.
And I think, if I may, we would really ask your code enforcement to make waterways clean, cut the weeds. We won't do that for you. The county won't do that for you. But the cities really need to do that to prevent the accumulation of these ponds once we get a flooding situation.
Will you let me know the last time somebody from your shop came over and made a presentation to code enforcement on that? And if it's been a while, we'll set it up.
It's been a while, and we'll set it up.
Okay.
We did have all the cities in the county invited to a meeting we had 8 months ago, 10 months ago?
Yeah.
10 months ago, where we talked about vector control issues in particular and talked to the cities and the county.
Yeah, I think it was a talk was should we be taking it over as the cities and the county, and we're not. So that, we, at least that's some
actually
of
what we talked about is trying to find a funding mechanism so that together the in particular the county and we can
the county
do this
already,
together.
We give you your property tax, the others don't, so get me going.
But the whole gist of the conversation is, you know, we are working in a proactive way to ensure we minimize public health dangers at all cost. We can't eliminate all, but we are here to help in proactive approach. Any questions, comments, concerns?
My
names for the fish?
Pond. I wonder if I should take these over the trough.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions aboard? It didn't sound like there were any. Building update.
Andy Glass, Director of Administration for the District, and my able assistant, Sharon McCoy-Huber. Thank you, Sharon. The building is actually progressing very well. Next slide, please. As you may have noticed, we have signage indicating our future home at the top of the marquees on both Meadows and Decatur Avenues. Next. On July 22nd, we had our grand opening.
Who is that?
For demolition.
It's
and we had
Papa
our very
Smurf.
Own demolition man on site to swing the first hammer and begin to take down the few walls that that were in the area. Next slide, please. There have been several things since we've started on the project that I think are of interest to the board. The first is noted in the blue area at the top of the screen. And to orient you to that, that's the driveway between the Brixton building. The Brixton is the balance of the plaza, and Brixton is the owner from whom we bought our property. To the left of the screen, you can see our building, the old SNHD building. One of the things that we ran into when we were going through code review and licensing and permitting from the city was that there had to be a 40-foot clearance from the property line to each of the buildings that were involved. And to make a long story short, because of the way that the property line ends up, we did not have that. So what we had to do was either come up with a no-build agreement with Brixton and ourselves for that particular area, or we would have been required to install three firewalls. And the three firewalls, to make a long story short, included not only construction from the floor to the roof and certain thickness so that it was a two-hour wall in each of those walls, but also we had to have a sprinkler deluge system. That would have been several hundred thousand dollars more. So what we did was we worked through our legal department and Annette with Brixton. We're able to come up with a no-build agreement between the two organizations, and that actually saved us money, which would have been an add to the project. A second thing I think that is important is if we look at the property that we own to the east, which would be the front of the building, we own the parking lot indicated by the dotted line that Sharon is outlining. That parking lot is fully our responsibility, obviously. But we have also talked with Brixton quite a bit about the necessity for us policing our parking in that area so that we don't interfere with the parking that's necessary for the plaza. To do that, we are in the process of implementing procedures through our security department to patrol and to make sure that all of our employees are identifying their cars so that we stay within that area. A third thing would be at the west side of the building, as Sharon is indicating with the red lines, we moved our parking compound for our corporate cars to the rear of the building. And that's where we're going to have the parking for our fleet. The only importance of that is that the reason that we moved it from there, from the southern parking area, which Sharon is indicating now, was because of, again, an interruption of fire service. Had we enclosed the parking area that Sharon is indicating now with a fence like we were going to have the area secured, we would have interfered with the fire hydrant, had to move the fire hydrant, and then become responsible for testing the fire system in a several-block area. So we decided not to do that. Another thing that we ran across was that when Dr. Iser actually came back from a meeting, he asked us about having a car charging station at the facility. We had not provided that originally, but the importance of that is that in order to provide a car charging facility, we had to increase the capacity of the emergency generator at the site. And we have subsequently done that and provided for the car charging station. Next slide, please. During the course of the construction, since it began on July 22nd, there's been a tremendous amount of work that's been completed. We have 35 to 40 workers on site at all particular time. The demolition has been completed. Actually, partitions are going up. The plumbing and the electrical that had to be sawn into the slab has been completed and is now being filled back in. The building is actually going through inspections by the city inspectors. The ductwork is about 75% complete, and we're about 25% complete with the building at this particular point in time. Next slide. Our schedule shows that we are going to be complete, and every week we review this with the contractor or the construction manager and the architect to ensure that we're on schedule. Our building is going to be complete by December 2nd of this year, so that during the month of December we're going to be beginning our move-in, starting with the Valley View building facility, followed by the 400 Shadow Lane facility and the TB clinic facility. Next slide. Our building funding is $10.9 million is what we had available to build the building. To make a long story short, the lower right-hand corner are funds needed for building not only this facility, but paying attention to what we are anticipating in Henderson is $11.3 million. There's approximately a $400,000 delta between the two at this point, which we're hoping to mitigate through efficiencies in the construction as we go through, and also in discussions with the city, we're very hopeful that we are going to have a contribution from the city towards this. And between the two, we hope to be able to bring the building in on budget. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you. What's a corporate car?
A company car, in the motor pool.
You have a motor pool. Cars, okay, correct. I didn't realize. That's what the SNHD symbol
correct.
On them. Okay.
Correct.
I see that the TB clinic is separate, but we used to also have the sexual diseases, whatever's separate. Is that still, will they go in through there or?
No, most of our clients will enter, if we can go through the front door where Sharon is pointing right now. The TB clinic is in the northwest corner, and that will be a separate entrance for TB only. In fact, that whole section of the building is actually, because of the way that the building was built to begin with, is actually a separate area of the building that's fully walled off, partitioned off, so that we have a completely unique air handling system, a negative pressure air handling
system.
That
was their plant area.
And have done all the finishes differently
so,
in that part of the
building. But I thought at the current building, didn't we used to have a separate entrance?
Yeah, it's one of the outbuildings behind the old building that we still have the TB clinic at. And I don't think you all have plans yet to raise it in the immediate future. I know that you...
I'm working on it.
I know you're working on it. We plan to be out of there by the end of December.
I just want to make sure, because sometimes it's uncomfortable for people that have to go get their STDs tests and so forth. And I thought that we used to have a separate entrance or a way for them to be able to access the building rather than having to go through it. I didn't see it up there when I noticed the TB clinic
entrance. There isn't one.
We do not have that.
We do not have a separate entrance for that.
You might want to think about that, or at least a kinder, gentler way to get people.
A separate entrance or a separate entrance from the TB entrance?
Just a separate entrance.
Well, wouldn't that bring more attention to it if it said get your STDs tested?
The old one always had a separate. The old one had a separate. That's why I'm asking if you didn't use it.
In other jurisdictions where I've been, maybe Andy can speak to this too, we haven't had separate entrances for the clinical programs from family planning versus immunizations versus
the old building
STDs.
Did, though.
Yeah, that I don't know.
And that's why
I
was asking that question, but because the old building did. So we just need to make sure we're not creating a problem where people don't feel comfortable about that any longer. And then have we looked to see if there's any opportunities for solar on your rooftop to help generate some revenue?
We actually did investigate that. And because of the fact that we're a government entity, we're not eligible for a lot of the credits that were available, so that it actually ends up being quite a bit more expensive for us.
When the city did theirs, Bob, did you guys? Because we did the demonstration project
grants
at the county, and that was a grant.
We got federal grants.
And those grants are no longer available.
Check with Green Chips. I'm chair, and we sometimes try to facilitate that, and I can't remember where we're at.
We'd
be happy
to do them for nonprofits. We did it for Salvation Army, but I can't remember where we found the financing for. But there might just be an opportunity there that helps you off-grid later on.
Sure.
And I'm glad you're doing the electric vehicles. I think all the local governments have pretty much been trying to put those in as they're doing their garages and such. Do you have daylighting?
Yes, we've actually installed 95 solar tubes is what we're putting in the facility so that we actually get daylight. It's all going to be through the ceiling, of course. And I don't know if you're familiar with solar tubes.
Some of your employees will need sunscreen.
Not to mention any in particular.
Are you looking at us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Board, any additional questions? Sounds like the project is on target.
If I may, this is the reason, among other many reasons, why we're going into the black in a year, year and a half, is because we're getting out of the onerous leases. We can't underestimate the contribution that the employees have made at all, but your forward sight in setting aside funds for us to be able to do this is really what has helped us get into that balanced budget area.
No rent equals
no
more
rent
programs.
Yep.
Totally agree.
Okay. That closes down agenda item 8. Agenda item 9 are the informational reports in your packets. Any questions on any of those? Hearing none, we enter agenda item 10, a period of public comment, where we will accept comments on any topic relevant to the board's jurisdiction. No action may be taken upon any matters raised under this item of the agenda until the matter has been agendized as an item, upon which action may be taken pursuant to NRS 241.020. Comments will be limited to 5 minutes per speaker. Please step up to the speaker's podium and clearly state your name and address. Spell your last name for the record. If any member of the board wishes to extend the length of a presentation, they may do so by majority vote, or I can just say, yeah, keep going.
Okay, Victoria Harding, SNHD and SEIU. I really, really love the fact that Dr. Eiser today said thank you to the employees for everything that they did in that contract. It was amazing. As one of the people who did the bargaining, there was not one person on that bargaining team who would have voted for a negative impact financially on the district. And all the employees behind us backed us on that. And that contract means a lot to us. It means everything to us. And what I would really, really ask is that you please respect our contract. We now have our second contract violation. That's not really a monetary issue. It's just a contract violation. And to break the intent of what we did in that room, especially through an interest-based bargaining where everything was really, you know, very nice and cozy, to then go back and say, you know what, I don't like what we determined, and I want to change that. To have our second one coming up now, the first one is off in arbitration. I just last night, well, I was at the executive board meeting for the union hall. Our lawyer told us that we got a letter last night or recently that said the district is not willing to arbitrate with us because they decide it is management's rights to break our contract, which is what they told us at the end of the grievance as well, that we don't want to go to arbitration. We did decide to go to arbitration. We were picking arbitrators. And again, we are now stuck at a standstill. Do you want to know how long this has been going on? Almost a year. So when you have an issue, it takes so long to get through that process, and I try to use the process. I mean, the contract is there for the reason to go through this, and I am really dedicated to going through the processes that are set up there. But now that we have the second one, and that is an issue for me because I am going through the process. I'm going through that with Andy. I have a great relationship with Andy. I have a good relationship with HR, and we're going to go through that process, however long that takes us. But the problem is, how they're breaking it, it's going to be done in September and October, the breaking of this contract. So what happens is, by the time I get to arbitration and get to paying these people back this money that they owed for work they didn't actually do, you know, how much time has gone on? And not only that, it's just disrespected the employees who worked so hard for you. And it just breaks my heart to have this kind of stuff happening. And, you know, last year I spoke out with Dr. Eiser's evaluation, and I spoke of three topics. One was employee morale, which you've all heard me talk about. I think it's important. Second was kind of an anti-union sentiment, which has since changed. Third was fix environmental health. What do I still talk about? Employee morale and environmental health. Environmental health needs a lot of help right now. These contract violations are all in environmental health. So it's not only, you know, issues within, you know, their area, personal issues and that. They've got contract violations as well. It's very hard on them, the work that they're doing. And they've stood by me throughout this entire process as I butt my head against the wall going through the process. And what people don't realize, you guys would probably realize this, but when I spoke at a Dr. Eiser's evaluation, one of the things I did is I said, what can I do to help, right? It's not just Dr. Eiser who has this responsibility. What can I do? What I did was I stopped talking to the board in there. I did that because I wanted to use the processes that were involved. So there were no emails. You guys didn't get emails from me, no phone calls for a period of time. And I did everything I could until I determined the system was broken. Then when I found the system was broken, I tried to fix the system. That didn't work because I found out the system was actually corrupt. So what do I do with a corrupt system? I did what I could. I documented every single thing. And I have that. I'm blessed, very, very blessed at the fact that we're at a point now where Andy and I are working on things. We're trying to have a better relationship. Communication is better. The problem is when I have a big issue of something that I need done, it's still getting stopped somewhere. And I can't move it forward. It's that corrupt part. It's not like corruption is the mob or anything. But corruption is like, you know, a file that's corrupt that you just can't do anything with it. And I can't get past it. And so through this year, the employees, they're the ones who've sat back there and stood by me this entire time. And something happened. It happened a little while ago, and I had said, all bets are off. I'm making personal, you know, meetings with everybody. That's it. You know, I can't do this because I can't go anywhere and do anything. And the employees started coming to me, and they said, we can't take it any longer. I said in February the employees are done. They're done. We're all wearing black today. I mean, we're overdone. We are baked. And something has to happen. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to respectfully step back, and I'm going to allow my colleagues to speak because maybe they can do something where I have honestly failed them. And so I want my colleagues to speak to you today and let you know the things that are going on. Thank you.
Please come forward, state your name, spell your last name for the record, and you have 5 minutes. Try to be brief. Try not to repeat something any other people have said.
Okay. My name is Sakina Alhassan, Alhassan. I am an environmental health food program. I would like to say that I'm coming before you as a last resort. Environmental health has been suffering a great deal for a long time, and our pleas have gone ignored. Today we've got a petition here from roughly 50% of the people of environmental health just asking for the comments of the 2015 employee satisfaction survey to be made public to you all. We would like that for people to see. We took time to complete that, and we'd like for everyone to be able to view it. We also would like the comments, the exit interviews from former environmental health employees since January 2014 to be made available to you so it can give you some better understanding as to why we are not retaining employees and some of the issues that are affecting environmental health. Okay. I hope that by speaking in public comment today that I'm not targeted nor retaliated against. I'm also hoping that this same courtesy is extended to my colleagues who were brave enough to tell me their stories. Let me just start off by saying that public health matters. This concept is not new to SNHD and has been the goal in previous years. And as the years progress, the data shows significant improvement in compliance in the establishments that we inspect. I would like to make it clear that there is no greater reward than working together with industry in a fair and respectful environment. For a director to refer to a geographic ethnic area as Nightmare on Elm Street in a staff meeting, or to say that the same group targets themselves in restaurant inspections, is not appropriate. And what we're asking is for the board to help banish this type of thinking from the Environmental Health Division at the Southern Nevada Health District. We as a division have currently lost sight of what we as environmental health specialists do. Our mission is to protect and promote the health, the environment, and the well-being of Southern Nevada residents and visitors. Empowering our operators to arm themselves with the knowledge to promote good public health practices is protecting public health. We do not protect public health by restructuring the standby program so that we respond to imminent health hazards the next day, or the proposed idea of announcing routine unannounced inspections prior to their occurrence to industry. Recently, those of us in the EH adjusted work list have been required by upper management for the next 2 months of September and October to adjust for permanent permits. With the last contract negotiation, the voluntary adjusted workday was developed to offset manpower costs needed to inspect large scale temporary events like Life is Beautiful and San Gennaro Fest. This is outlined in Article 22.1-F of the current SEIU contract and in the fall of 2014 referenced in a PowerPoint presentation developed by upper management, the then executive steward of the union, and a representative of HR. If we think back to the original presentation, upper management pledged two things: that EH would not receive overtime for temporary events aforementioned, and that in regards to fee increases, the proposed fee increases, that we would not receive overtime for these temporary events. And I regretfully inform you that this pledge no longer holds merit. In a meeting with EH Management, it was stated that we are, quote, shifting the intention of the current contract from temporary permits to permanent permits. For those who have been here long enough, we have been down this road before. And to allow this to happen is only going to further decimate employee morale. Speaking of employee morale, it is not appropriate for a director to humiliate staff in front of the public, as in a July 18th incident in Laughlin where staff was publicly shamed. Good leadership does not include staff intimidation nor verbal abuse. What it does include is drawing upon your talented staff to offer their expertise in situations where others may be deficient. I understand that no work environment is perfect, but what I cannot accept is an environment in which inspectors are disrespected in the field by industry members who have been empowered with the misinformation that we as inspectors need to be retrained or should attain master's degrees in inspections, as referenced by Ms. Rezatar in a February 18, 2015 SNHD industry staff meeting. We are asking for transparency from upper management, fairness, and respect for employees not only as professionals but as human beings. I want to make it clear that the issues in EH are not only union issues but employee issues. I am speaking on behalf of the EH staff that was brave enough to be honest and candidly comment on the 2015 employee satisfaction survey. Thank you for all of those who wore black today in support of basic human rights. I am asking that the comments and all exit interviews from former SNHD employees since January 2014 be made accessible to the Board of Health as the voice of those who are unable to stand before you today will mirror some of the issues I have already addressed. I am humbly asking the Board to restore the ethics and principles that once encompassed the Southern Nevada Health District, including honoring the current SEIU contract. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Unless board members have a comment.
I do. We got the preliminary results back in May, but never the finalized. And we've never really discussed it as a board, so maybe that's something else that could be provided to us along with.
We'll make sure that they get a copy again if they don't.
Results are out, and I thought that we presented them to you.
I just
you
went
with
back through
Shirley's
and had
updates.
My staff look. We had a preliminary on May 6th. I haven't seen anything since then, but I could have. I've been in a fog from time to time. But I do think we should, as a board, we directed and asked that the employee satisfaction survey be done for a reason and that we then look and work together on how to implement it. I think there's some factors that we still have to take a look at. I don't want to be back again. I've been on this board long enough where it's become an unhealthy health district again. And employee morale is very important. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so I think we still have some discussions to have, Mr. Chair.
So do we want to put that on the next meeting agenda?
I would appreciate it.
A presentation on that?
Could you define the presentation on the final?
On the final results.
Employee results and then right. What conclusions? Did some of it go to labor and management to work through? Did some of it was some of it addressed by HR? Did you as
right. Well,
doing a result and then not doing anything with it is kind of senseless.
Well, Shirley has provided those presentations to you every month since then up until I think even including last month, but we'd be happy to do another presentation.
There's a few new individuals, and I do think to some extent we never resolved. If I remember in the preliminary results, with no disrespect, EH was the big problem area. It was some odd percentage. I don't have them in front of me. But you know what?
Today I will give you my resignation. Today you're safe. You can go back to the environment that you feel comfortable with. I'm done today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That works.
That doesn't work for me. So I will try to talk Ms. Rezatar into staying. It's easy for, and you've seen this happen before I got here, where employees came up and either intimidated parts of the board or intimidated other employees into resigning or not having their contracts extended. Ms. Rezatar is doing, in my opinion, a very, very good job. It's under Ms. Rezatar that we had the compliments that Mr. DeBine and Mr. Coyle provided and Mr. the person who gave me the wording for the
the mattress regulations. I'm sorry? Mr. Campbell. So I think that we've made great strides here in the district related to how we work with our regulated industries. That has upset a lot of environmental health registered REHSs because they don't like the fact that we're working with industry in a partnership to try to improve the health and safety of restaurants, pools, and the other regulated industries. So it's not fine with me that she has given a resignation until she writes it. I won't accept it.
And that's your decision, Dr. Iser?
It is my decision.
But what I'm going to say is I don't believe that favoritism within the industry, and when I hear from my small mom and pops that are not being regulated appropriately, where there's attitudes towards my Hispanic and Asian families, then I got a problem with that within your EH department. Piss me off.
Sure. You can come forward and state your name, spell your last name, 5 minutes.
Hello, my name is Al Sang, S-A-N-G, and I've been with SNHD for the past decade. I just want to have it for the record that I haven't been intimidated to come up here. But I do want to state for the record that in my over 10 years with the district, we are at one of our lowest point in morale. It is not true, as it has been said, that we dislike working with industry. We, as environmental health specialists, food ops, do nothing more than work with industry. And despite several years of being short-staffed, of having more demands and requirements on us, we have always stepped up and met the challenge. Our professional integrity doesn't allow us for any less than that. However, for the record, our morale is very low. And when you have a fighting force that is in the front line, that is demoralized, those of you who have been in the armed forces should know what the outcome is. Thank you very much.
Any additional public comment? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the public comment portion. Item 10, Mr. Dobine.
Just having come from one of the regulated industries under the previous regime, one of my big motivating factors for being up here was the abuse that environmental health piled on the industry. And I understand Jackie still has some challenges to overcome, but if a lot of you knew where we used to be, it was deplorable. I'm speaking as the industry representative, not necessarily representing the staff. But I've seen some improvements and great improvements in how industry is treated now. Like I said, some of the things were just deplorable that was being done. So that's all I want to say.
In solid waste industry, you were talking about.
Yeah, that's correct, in the solid waste industry.
So that needs to be separated from food. Thank you.
Well, that just makes common sense, Commissioner June Giuliani.
Thank you. Every once in a while I get there.
Okay, we are adjourned.